You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
I'd like to welcome you all to Brookings. I just would like to let everybody in the audience know that you're on live TV. We have colleagues from C-SPAN 2 over here, so please be on your best behavior. We'll certainly try to be from up here on the podium as well. I think we also have some colleagues from Iceland TV as well at the back, who we're very pleased to have here, because this is obviously a very special event to mark the 30th anniversary of the Reykjavik summit in Iceland. I'm Fiona Hill, the director of the Centre on the United States and Europe, and it's my great pleasure to be here today and to have the opportunity to moderate a panel of three extremely distinguished people who all have their own connection to this summit 30 years ago. 30 years ago, I was just starting off in university, watching all of these gentlemen on television and, you know, wondering how this was all going to turn out. So it's quite a... Well, for the younger people in the audience, just think, you know, where you might be in 30 years' time. You never, just never know. We actually are using this occasion to also get ahead of another big anniversary, which will be coming up at the end of this year, which is the 25th anniversary of the collapse of the Soviet Union. We can be sure there'll be lots of events related to this and also to the independence of all of the former republics of the Soviet Union, including the Russian Federation, after the end of this year. But we thought that Reykjavik was actually an extremely important anniversary. And we'd like to welcome here the ambassador of Iceland, Geir Haarde. Very pleased that you could be here with us in the front of the audience. Because Reykjavik was one of the key events that led up to the end of the Cold War. It was one of the key meetings between the United States and the Soviet Union in that whole succession of events that preceded the fall of the Berlin Wall. And so we're going to do a two-panel event today. This first panel will focus on the significance of the summit itself with three people who were there and the importance of the bilateral US and Soviet effort to walk back from the brink of nuclear confrontation. The second panel, which is going to be moderated by our colleague Angela Stent, is going to hone in on the general issue of arms reduction and arms control after Reykjavik and assess the merits of using nuclear arms control as the basis for a new relationship between the Soviet Union and the United States, then between Russia and the United States over the last three decades. Now, obviously, developments over the last couple of days have put that back on the agenda again, with Russia pulling out of the Plutonium Disposition Act. We did not know this was going to happen, although sometimes I think that my colleague Steve Pfeiffer is a little bit prescient on these. He insisted on us holding the event on this day on October 4th, and I'm wondering if he knew that something else was going to happen on October 3rd. So it actually puts the whole agenda of arms control and the confrontation between Russia and the United States, sadly, back at the top of the agenda in the news again. So I want to just begin the panel with a little bit of scene setting. Not everybody in the audience will remember these days as well as our panelists of the 1980s. Some people in the audience are probably not born then. But it's worth reminding us that the 1980s were years of heightened Cold War confrontation, and there was a real risk of nuclear war. And I just want to go through a few quick points and then turn over to our panelists for a discussion of this. We had, of course, detente between the United States and the Soviet Union and Europe and the Soviet Union in the 1960s and 1970s. But by the 1980s, the Soviet Union was actually convinced that the United States had become a clear and present danger. They were spending all of their time poring over US defense budgets, global US military exercises, American and NATO air probes near sensitive Soviet borders. Sounds a little bit familiar, like some of the problems we're seeing today. Statements by top White House and Pentagon officials like Ken Edelman, and increased operations by the CIA in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And by 1981, the Kremlin leadership was thoroughly convinced that the United States was a nuclear threat. March 1983, there was a full-scale war scare. This was just after US President Ronald Reagan had announced the development of the Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars, the land-based anti-ballistic missile defense system that was supposed to shield the United States from a Soviet nuclear strike. And Yuri Andropov, who had just moved from leading the KGB to then rather briefly becoming the General Secretary of the Soviet Union, head of the Soviet state, in 1982 accused Ronald Reagan of plotting a nuclear holocaust. The tension was palpable throughout Europe as well as in the United States. And during a British war game to test NATO's preparations for a Soviet nuclear strike, as we now know, thanks to the declassification of British archives, Queen Elizabeth II actually drafted a World War III speech. She had an address that was filed away in the archives and only revealed a few years ago, basically urging Britons, as one might expect, to remain united and resolute against the madness of nuclear war. And this was drafted almost the same time as President Ronald Reagan made his very famous Evil Empire speech on March 8, 1983, about the dangers posed to the United States in the way of life of the Soviet Union. So, things were pretty bad in 1983. They got worse at the end of that year. People might remember that Soviet warplanes intercepted and shot down a South Korean Airlines plane, KL-007, believing it was a US spy plane as it was flying from Alaska to Seoul. And the whole idea of an impending nuclear World War III was reverberating around in pretty much every world capital. 1984, August 1984, just as we run up to one of these events, Ronald Reagan frightened everybody, just be careful because we're on live mics, with one of the most infamous hot mic incidents in international affairs when he joked on US National Public Radio just before a live broadcast in California, "My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We'll begin bombing in 5 minutes." As we now know from declassified Soviet archives, nobody got the joke there, and complete panic set in Moscow. So it was only when these gentlemen all came along, after March 1985, when Mikhail Gorbachev came into power to replace Andropov, a Soviet general secretary, that things started to calm down. In November 1985 in Geneva, Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan held their first meeting between a Soviet and American leader. It was the first meeting in 7 years. And then they began the whole process leading up to Reykjavik that would start to put a rest to all these tensions and the war scares of the early 1980s. So the Reykjavik summit 30 years ago was a key part of that process. It would ultimately lead to the signing of the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, INF Treaty, which of course is under something of a cloud also at the moment, and lay the ground for the 1991 First START Treaty. Initially, as we'll hear from our panellists, the summit seemed to be a bit of a failure. And its immediate aftermath was, again, another of those Cold War familiar scenarios of tit-for-tat spy expulsions from the US Embassy in Moscow and the Russian Embassy here. Steve Pfeiffer, who will be on the next panel, was actually in the US Embassy in Moscow then and spent most of his time having to fill in for vital personnel staff who had been expelled and driving a truck instead of doing his analysis on Russian political and military affairs. And, of course, US journalist Nick Daniloff, who later on became a professor at Northeastern University of Journalism, was actually arrested and imprisoned in a Soviet jail. So that was all that was going on. But behind the scenes at Reykjavik, things were actually quite different, as we're now going to hear from our panel. So we first of all have, to kick us off, Brookings president, Strobe Talbott, who was covering Reykjavik in his capacity at that point as Washington bureau chief for Time magazine. We also have our good colleague and friend Marvin Kalb, who is the veteran CBS and NBC News correspondent. I believe then you were the anchor for Meet the Press,
yes,
as well as many other capacities at that time, Marvin. And then we have distinguished American diplomat Arthur Ken Edelman, who has just published a new book, Reagan at Reykjavik, 48 Hours, the End of the Cold War, and it's on sale outside the auditorium. You probably saw at the very beginning already fans of Ken running up with books to be signed. And Ken was there with President Ronald Reagan behind the scenes with Soviet General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev. And after we've had some of the atmospherics and observations from Strobe and Marvin, is going to tell us what really went on behind closed doors. So thank you very much for joining us. It's very exciting to have such a great panel and to actually have people who are present at the events. And we're very much looking forward to hear what you have to say. Strobe, over to you.
Thanks, Fiona. That's a terrific setup for a really quite important story. And I think those of us who were there, including, of course, Marvin and Ken, knew that there were some possibilities. But I don't think any of us had even an inkling of how far these two leaders, Gorbachev and Reagan, would actually go. Ken is the only person probably in the room, but certainly on the on the podium who was behind the closed doors. Marvin and I were trying to listen through keyholes if we could find any, and I'll come back to that in just a second. But just to fill out a little bit of what Fiona just said, this was still fairly early in the blossoming of the personal relationship between the President of the United States and then who was the General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. There were signs that things might warm up. The Geneva meeting that happened the year before the atmospherics were pretty good, and they certainly were better than the relationship or the non-relationship between President Reagan and Andropov, not to mention Chernenko. But we had no idea as we got onto the press plane and headed to Reykjavik, of all places, if I can say that, Mr. Ambassador. And by the way, the site was actually picked because it was more or less halfway between Moscow and Washington. So neither leader had to go too far in the direction of the other was sort of the idea. It was October, obviously. It was blustery. The little house, can we see that? And they can't, but
yeah.
Okay. Hofty House. I checked this with the ambassador before, who confirmed that it was reputed to be haunted. and that's where everything went on. As the weekend developed, we began to get briefings from Ken. I can't remember if you did any of them yourself.
Larry Speaks.
Yeah, and I think actually Secretary Shultz came out at one occasion while things were looking pretty good. And it sounded as though it was going to be actually not just a placeholder for a more substantive summit later in the year, but big things were going on in the House. We at Time Magazine usually closed our weekly magazine on Friday night so that it could come out on Monday morning, and all of the signals were positive. So we had a number of photographs of Reagan and Gorbachev smiling and looking triumphant, one of which was, I think David Hume Kennerly took it, was on the, was all ready to go. I had written the cover story. My editor, somebody you may have heard of, Walter Isaacson, back in New York, was helping me put the finishing touches on it. About 4 o'clock in the afternoon of that Sunday, 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday, when the magazine was supposed to hit the streets, the next morning, George Shultz came out into the press room, and you could tell from his face, you could tell from the tears that were in his eyes, that the whole thing had collapsed. This led to one of the more exciting moments in my journalistic career. I had to get on the telephone immediately, called Walter back in New York, and said the equivalent of "Baby, get me rewrite," and I started dictating what we were hearing from Shultz and others who told us why the talks had collapsed. The word "laboratory" kept coming up, and I think I'll save that for you, Ken. So we managed to flip a happy story into an unhappy story. We found an unhappy picture of the two of the two leaders, and we got your Time Magazine into your hands about 7 o'clock the next morning. But that's not really anything more than background and color.
That's an amazing thing.
What I think is really important about what we're going to be talking about in the next little while is that while it was a busted summit, it showed the degree to which these two men, getting, by the way, a lot of pushback from their military and their political advisors. These two men were determined to, rather than having the United States and the Soviet Union constantly looking over the brink that would take us into global thermonuclear war, they were serious about not just arms control, but massive, massive reductions of the arsenals of the two countries. Even though the Reykjavik summit didn't achieve for reasons having primarily to do with SDI, it did create a kind of, if I can put it this way, a launching pad for the arms control agreements that were reached during not just the years but the decades that follows, which will bring us to a melancholy present where so much of that progress unfortunately has either been stalled or also and is going to be very, very hard to pick up on. So with that, I will turn it to my traveling companion back in those days, who always was wearing a red tie, by the way.
Same red tie.
I just put on a tie for all of you, and certainly didn't have a tie on when I was rewriting the story over the telephone with Walter. So over to you, Marvin.
Thank you very much, Strobe, and it's a pleasure to be with you guys on this panel. I have covered many Soviet-American summits. It was my great pleasure to do so. There were great stories, and for someone who had spent much of his life either in Russia or studying Russia, I was fascinated by what was going on, and most especially with the arrival of Gorbachev on the scene. And Reykjavik, for me, was an enormous disappointment. I think it was a summit, you could almost say, that shouldn't have happened. And I appreciate what Strobe was saying, that it did set certain things up. But two men were that close to something that was truly historic and could not pull it off. And when you looked at Secretary Shultz's face when he walked out, it seemed as if he had just been informed that his wife and children had died in an automobile accident. He looked awful. And as a reporter, you looked at that and you knew, if you had done any advance work at all, you realized that Gorbachev was trying to reach out to the West. He was aware that three of his leaders had died within the previous 4 years. He was a young man and he thought he could do something different with Russia. And so very quickly, he initiated a program that was called Glasnost Perestroika, the idea of reforming Russia. And his vision was that you can hold on to communism if you could somehow reform a system that was broken. The truth of the matter is, it was so broken that you could not continue and reform wouldn't work, but he didn't know that then. And he started in January of that year floating the idea of eliminating all nuclear weapons by the year 2000. A number of people in this city, I remember, I will not mention names, but some of the people said it's a lot of propaganda, it's a lot of nonsense. And that might have been the truth, but that's what he said, and he put that out there. And then the following month, out of the Soviet Foreign Office came word that the linkage that had been a Soviet requirement on all of the agreements, you had to have all or nothing. They pulled back from that. They were saying, maybe you could get one. And then behind it all was the awareness that Afghanistan was a monstrous headache and an obvious defeat. And how does a Soviet leader acknowledge that to his people? 13,000 soldiers had been killed. How do you acknowledge that to the mothers and the fathers? That was a tough thing. And he began to pull out. When he first came in, he said, this is a bleeding wound, and we've got to end it. So he was aware, he was under incredible pressures. He was trying to do something different. And the stage was Reykjavik. And for a reporter there, you realize this was a big deal, although we were being told by our briefers, not Ken, others, that this was just a setup for what would be a Gorbachev visit to the United States, followed the following year by a Reagan visit to Moscow. And yet, behind the scenes, as we will hear, they were discussing things that were unbelievably important to the world and to the two countries. Gorbachev was there with that idea in the final analysis of eliminating nuclear weapons, all nuclear weapons, by the year 2000. The president was fascinated by the idea. Reagan, despite the image of being the conservative, wouldn't get along with Russia. Reagan wanted to get along with Russia. He wanted to get along with everybody, but more or less on his terms. And Reagan had a romantic attachment to SDI, to what we in the press called Star Wars. And that romantic attachment was complete. It was total. And if you had a choice at a certain point in that negotiation of saying, maybe we could both agree on eliminating all nuclear weapons by the year 2000. But Gorbachev wanted, first, the elimination of the idea of SDI. That didn't work. And then there was the possibility of a compromise. Reagan wanted the ability to test not only in the laboratory, but also in the skies. And Gorbachev was prepared, so I was told by Russians, whom I trusted at the time, Gorbachev was prepared to accept the idea of testing in the laboratory, but not in the skies. But the president would not accept that. And so at the end of the day, what was explained to us by Secretary Shultz and by others later was that, yes, this was possible, but the president would not yield on SDI, and therefore nothing was possible. And that, to me, is, as someone who's given up journalism long ago, I just think back upon it now, absorbed with writing about the history of Russia and the Soviet Union, and about ourselves and our dealings with Russia. You think back to that time, my God, we've had nothing quite like it since or before. And how fantastic it would have been if one or the other had been able to make that final break with advisors who were kept saying, no, easy does it, boy, don't go too fast, don't go too far. And a president who really wanted to do it, everything in Hollywood in him moved him to make a big, sensational statement. But he was in love with SDI, and therefore he couldn't pull it off. And that sounds to me like just a sad story, and I'm sorry to have to report it.
well done, Marvin, with tears in your eyes as well. I suppose another of the issues we should have mentioned that framed the summit was, of course, Chernobyl. And yes. Gorbachev had just come straight out of having to deal with Secretary General, early on in his term, this devastating accident in a civilian nuclear complex, which had had very large effects. And Iceland, in fact, like many other countries in Northern Europe, had been under the plume of radioactive material that emanated from Chernobyl. So that that would also have set the scene, certainly for Gorbachev, of thinking about this in a different way.
Very
so, Ken, Marvin has portrayed some of the motivations and ideas of Reagan. What was it like behind the scenes?
Well, Marvin was saying it was a very sad event. I'm going to tell you why it was a very happy event. And Strobe told us why it was a very amazing event. The most amazing is to see on Monday when we got back, there was Time magazine with David Kennerly's picture on the cover, and thinking, my God, this is a printing, distribution, and editorial triumph of the first order. that it was flown out there.
There were some grammatical errors in the
I thought there were errors of view rather than the grammatical I overlooked as rather minor. As Marvin said, you know, the Gorbachev on the scene was an amazing change. Starting in 83, there was Brezhnev's death, and then he was replaced by Andropov. And then 14 months later, because of a bad kidney, Andropov died. And then Chernyenko was there and helped with two armpits into every room. And then he died. Carol and I were very good friends then of the Italian ambassador, and he was telling us he was going to Chernyenko's funeral. And I said to him, well, why are you doing that? He says, I bought tickets to the entire series. So he was used to going back and forth from this. So I thought that to give a happy story, Marvin, and to cheer you up, which has always been one of my objectives in life, to cheer you up.
You have been an utter failure.
All right. I just wanted to cheer you up for a few minutes, all right?
Okay.
I want to do three things. And Fiona, you were great to give us the background of that. Three things I want to do is, number one, in a jiffy way, tell you what actually happened at Reykjavik. Number two, telling you the significance of what happened at Reykjavik. And number three, telling you how my views differ with the views we heard in some respects from the other three, the moderator and the two participants. Okay? This is the Hofty House, amazingly isolated, as the ambassador knows, thought to be haunted. It even now is called the Haunted House on that. And a very small and beautiful, beautiful house right on the outskirts of Reykjavik. It's very exciting because Carol and I are going there on Friday for Iceland is doing a big event for the 30th anniversary. So it'll be terrific to go back and see it where I know that my wife doesn't like me to say this, but it was the greatest weekend of my life. And it was with the ups and downs and ins and outs and the thrill and the misery, even before I saw Marvin out there, but was wonderful. Okay, real quick, this is the Time magazine that Strobe wrote about in 1983. In Aspen, we have a collection of all the Time magazine men of the year, and we have this on the wall, you'll be happy to know, with Reagan's signature. It's Andropov and Reagan looking like they're
you
in
didn't
a duel.
Get your, our You didn't get Andropov's signature.
No, I did not get it. He died too quickly. Yeah. But it's like they're in a duel. Instead of shooting each other with pistols, a la Hamilton and Burr, they are going to go after each other with thermonuclear events. And it was a very scary time, as Fiona pointed out, and as Strobe wrote out in this cover story, Men of the Year. And they're looking very somber. On that. This is the Hofty House. You see the size of it from right there. I'll give you a quick tour. The upper left chamber was the American chamber where we were waiting with the president, or we were waiting and met with the president. You'll see the inside of that in a minute. The upper right bedroom was the Soviet parlor, and that part in between was the DMZ, the demilitarized zone between the two. The window on the left on the main floor is where the two met. They met for 10 and a half hours. I don't know about you, but I never met anybody for one weekend in 10 and a half hours. And this is virtually without notes, without memos, without talking points. This is the most genuine either man was in office. In office, when you're, I don't know, when you're President of the United States, but I assume when you're General Secretary of the Soviet Union, you have all these kind of scripted meetings that you go through and everything with talking points and with memos and do this and don't do that and watch that and all that. None of this. This was a come-as-you-are summit. This is a free-floating kind of thing, the likes of which will never be repeated. We got into the bubble there, and it was the smallest bubble ever made, which is the room within a room for secret talks. And there were eight of us in the bubble, jammed in shoulder to shoulder, knee to knee, and all of a sudden the gigantic doors open, and it's announced the President of the United States is there. So all of us stand up, and we're belly to belly right there. And I thought, if I am going to stay in this bubble, and I am going to stay in the bubble, I better give the president my chair. And so I said, sit here. And for the next 50 minutes, I was 40 minutes, I was leaning against the presidential knees as we had the first look at what Gorbachev wanted to do. It was a very exciting time. That's a huff the house. This is Miss World. It's not Miss Universe. It wasn't. She was not the worst Miss World in the world. But I thought that she had been from Iceland and just crowned the month before. I thought this would make a great cover for my book, help sales. But somehow the publisher thought it was a little off subject. But, you know, 50 Shades of Ice or something. I don't know. For search engines, that's what I really wanted. Okay, this is the Prime Minister of Iceland in his bathing suit right there, talking to a young Tom Brokaw. They wanted to do interviews, and Iceland was ill-equipped to handle the world's attention. They thought there were going to be very few press there. On the opening of the summit, there were 3,167 members, like Marvin Kalb, accredited to the press. And the Prime Minister, I don't know why his press guy on the far right didn't give him a towel or something on that, but he's doing an interview. Here's the room that I showed you. It's a very small room. You have Shevardnadze starting to sit down right there. Across from him, George Shultz. Shultz still alive at 92, 93, doing great. He was so nice, came to a book party and spoke for 45 minutes about Reykjavik. It was just wonderful. The president and Gorbachev. And then you see the two translators. So it was kind of simultaneous. It was not sequential. And a note taker. And the note takers are important because George Washington University, and thank you for that, has put the notes online. And these are the American notes and the Soviet notes from the summit. And that's something we didn't know. I didn't know at the time. We heard the president give a kind of garbled 10-minute recap of what happened for an hour and a half. But till you see these notes, you don't see the back and forth, and they're very, very interesting on that 10 and a half hours of those notes. This is the Hofty House where we met Saturday night. I was kind of disappointed because Joan Baez was giving a concert downtown. It was a street festival, and I was looking forward to that. But we went to the Hofty House. Akram Mayoff was in charge of their group. Richard Pearl, who's back there in the audience, was a part of our group and a very important part of it. We met at 8 o'clock at night. We took a break at 3:15 till about 3:45. We then adjourned at 6:20 in the morning. And I don't know about you, Richard, or others, but I had never done an all-nighter before, even in college. I'd missed that ritual. And we had, by our estimation, accomplished more on the strategic realm in that one night than we had in 7.5 years of negotiations with the Soviets in Geneva. More in one night than 7.5 years. We did not do much on INF, besides go back and forth on our positions. We did not do much on SDI, because the two presidents not only liked to talk about SDI, they loved to talk about SDI. And that was one of the remarkable parts of that 10.5 hours. The more one jacked up the other on the SDI threat from Gorbachev and promise from Reagan, the more each other believed it. And it was just flights of fantasy, if I may say, on both sides, but they did us well. This is Akram Mayoff on the left right there. Who later committed suicide, actually, when the Soviet Union fell. And I kept up with him over the years, and it was quite a shock when that happened. This is Sunday afternoon. This is the only, so correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's the only summit, certainly U.S.-Soviet, U.S.-Russia summit that's gone into sudden death overtime. It was supposed to end at noon on Sunday. They decided, because they were back and forth, that they would go into overtime. The president comes up about 3 o'clock, 3:30 in the afternoon on Sunday, sits in the corner, says, I'll go down one more time, but that's about it. I promised Nancy I'd be home for dinner tonight. We explained that Nancy's going to know where you are. It's not like you stopped in the bar on the way home. You know, there's 3,127 journalists there. There's one story in the world, as Marvin will tell us. And he says, I know, but I told her I'd be home for dinner. And so we're going over that. And you can see Paul Nitza on your left, who did the all-nighter. Don Regan, the president, George Shultz, Poindexter, myself. And here is Circle, that good-looking guy who's really showing his best side right there. Between me and Shultz is Richard Pearl. And let me just say, you've never looked better, Richard, on that. That was before I dyed my hair, to tell you the truth, white, so I look distinguished now. But anyway, it was trying to come up with words that would bridge the gap. And the gap was a fundamental one. It was that that Gorbachev wanted to confine SDI to the laboratory, and Reagan did not want it confined. We were agreed to keep within the ABM treaty and confine SDI in that way for 10 more years till 1996, but not in the laboratory on that. The myth came up that, as Marvin mentioned, that you know, the advisors were all over the place. That's not exactly what happened, because Ronald Reagan knew what he wanted. He did not want to give up SDI. And so I don't think there was one time over the weekend where he asked any of us what we thought. He knew what he thought, and that was good enough for him. It didn't work. They went back and forth. It's wonderful to read the notes of the transcripts. They weren't transcripts, the notes of the American and Soviet note takers, because what's wonderful is, and it's really a case study in leadership, the last half hour, they were both trying to bridge this gap. They knew how important it all was, and they started talking about seeing the situation in each other's shoes. So Reagan was talking about the problems that Gorbachev might have at the Kremlin and how to solve them. Gorbachev started talking about the problems that Reagan had. It was just a beautiful, beautiful kind of thing. And they were kind of pleading with each other, come on, can't you do this, can't you do this? Ronald Reagan was the maddest we've ever seen. We went back to the ambassador's house where he was staying, minus the ambassador who had been kicked out for the weekend. And he was just walking back and forth and back and forth and absolutely furious about what might have been. His handler, the fellow who was with him, Jim, I forgot his last name, for 8 years in the White House, just to handle where he goes and stuff like that, gave at the Miller Center in the University of Virginia, said basically he's never seen the president so agitated as at this time, except when Nancy was going into surgery. He was agitated. Strobe, there is the picture you chose, the Kennerly picture, and that, the no deal. Star Wars sinks the summit. I didn't think that was exactly fair. I thought that Gorbachev's tying of Star Wars to the end of the summit that was not done until Sunday morning really sank the summit. But Strobe, you are absolutely right that Star Wars was at the center of the controversy for that. And it was all a failure. It was one big failure. And so that's basically what happened. A lot of details can be filled in, but you can buy many, many copies of the book and give them out for Halloween is coming up. It's a great Halloween present, Thanksgiving. Whole family would be happy. No, anyway, you can see that. Now, second part, what came out of it? Three things came out of Reykjavik, okay? Number one was the arms control track. This is signing the INF agreement, the Intermediate Nuclear Force Agreement in the White House in December 1987 for the summit right there. What it did was basically the zero option that had been Reagan's opening bid for the negotiations back in 82, and it eliminated this class of weapon system from both the Soviet side and the American side. It was a great deal because by then the Soviets had 5,500 warheads facing at all the capitals of Europe. It was the number one issue of NATO when Reagan came in office, and that was eliminated, the number one issue of Reagan. And that was signed in the East Room of the White House right there. Number two, that's on the INF level. On the strategic level, it started a on the basis of just exactly what Strobe said, on the basis of what we agreed on that all night negotiations with Akhramayev, was down to equal levels, real reductions for strategic nuclear weapons. Okay? And this was important because every other previous arms control, the SALT I and SALT II, that both of which I thought were a bad idea, to tell you the truth, had limited the growth of nuclear weapons. No one until Ronald Reagan had really started to have a decline in nuclear weapons. That's why we changed START, the strategic arms limitation talks from SALT to START. Strategic arms limitation talks to START, strategic reductions talks. And it was a very big move. Right now, the Russians have about one-fourth that they had in terms of nuclear stockpiles at the time of Reykjavik. So that's the second on the strategic realm. Didn't come during Reagan's time. It came during George Herbert Walker Bush's time. And then it's continued for George W., the Clinton years, the Bush years, Bush II, and then Obama's latest one. And we'll hear about that more on the second panel. Third thing I want to do is the most controversial, and that is, did Reykjavik really contribute to the end of the Cold War? Okay? There's a lot of argument about this, and the simple answer is you can't say, because causation in history, in social science, in any case, is always a mystery. You can tell about causation. I personally believe that Reykjavik did several things. Number one, it legitimized the no nuclear cause in a very big way. It is remarkable to think that before Reykjavik, the idea of abolishing the bomb, the abolition, was, you know, something to have folk singers sing about and naive people, you know, write about and Nobel laureates in physics talk about and things like that. It wasn't mainstream. It is amazing that after Reykjavik, with Ronald Reagan as the poster boy, the number of key participants at Reykjavik who bought onto the no nuclear, the abolition, ban the bomb movement. That includes Ronald Reagan, includes George Shultz, that's made him a centerpiece of his life in government, and includes Paul Nitze, who knew more about nuclear weapons than any of us. That includes Max Kampelman, who devoted his life to the cause, includes Bill Krau, chairman of the Joint Chiefs at the time, includes Jack Matlock, who is an American ambassador to Russia, and then just a lot more, Sam Nunn, Henry Kissinger, Bill Perry. It became a respectable movement after Reykjavik and because of Reykjavik. Now, the main argument I would make is the end of the Soviet Union. How did that happen? In my mind, Reykjavik contributed because Gorbachev saw that that there was no way Reagan was going to give up SDI. The only thing he could do to get SDI, which he thought was absolutely the most threatening weapon system to him and to the world, after learning about it, he grew it way out of proportion. He gave the first address that any foreign than any Soviet leader gave after a foreign meeting to the Soviet people on the night he got back from Reykjavik, said explicitly, and I think I quote him pretty exactly, SDI is a threat to the very existence of our country. It's a threat to mankind everywhere in all time. I mean, you know, this is a little research program in the Pentagon that, you know, may someday show some promise, but a little, you know, pimple on the Pentagon budget, less than that. Half a pimple on the Pentagon budget, and he's blowing it up as a threat of all time. He could get Reagan to give up SDI if he made the offer on the reductions of nuclear weapons good enough. He tried that at Reykjavik. It totally failed. And then the only alternative open to him was to reform the Soviet Union so that it could compete technologically. And once he started the reforms, which started before Reykjavik, but were vastly accelerated after Reykjavik, with the Central Committee meeting first, then with the Party Congress, and then the next year with the Party Conference, the first one since Stalin, that implemented these reforms, so sweeping, and the reforms smashed the Soviet Union. That's my thesis, and I know that Strobe and probably Marvin will disagree with it, but we can talk about that later. Two or three little points I would make on the opening remarks of others. Fiona, I think you gave a great background. One of the things I've learned in debates over the years is never pick a fight with a moderator. Pick a fight with everybody else. Fiona, there's one thing I would disagree with. When you say it's absolutely that the Soviet Union feared an American nuclear attack during those years, and because of the succession of provocative statements by Reagan and actions, that's an argument that, you know, I used to deal with every year because I shared a birthday with Robert McNamara, and he would invite me to breakfast, and he would have the same argument every year until I gave up the breakfast. And I made the same point every year, which shows you how effective I was on the point. I said, you know, I understand he had just always come back from Moscow just for this, and not for this, our breakfast, but, you know, he had been going back and forth there, and he said, basically, the Soviet Union was scared out of its mind about an American nuclear attack. And I said, well, you know, last time I checked, all their bombers are lined up on the airfield right there. All their submarines, at over 90% of their submarines are in port at any one time. We never had 50% of our bombers on any airfield at any time. 50% had to be in the air. The submarine port was, I don't know what the numbers were, but way over half had to be at sea at any one time. If he was scared to death, why didn't he do something about it? Why didn't the Soviet Union do anything about it? I mean, they were there talking about getting attacked by nuclear weapons, but they had no, you know, easy actions that we could have done on that. On the point you made, Marvin, about Gorbachev wanting to abolish nuclear weapons, and some people in the hardline administration saying it's all propaganda, I was one of those people. The fact is that Khrushchev had said it all during the 50s. It had been said by, you know, all the dead Soviet leaders before that. It was pretty standard fare. I didn't believe it for a minute. I didn't believe it till Reykjavik, to tell you the truth. And I believe he was really sincere after Reykjavik. I really, looking back now, I was wrong in thinking that was just propaganda at the time. Because Gorbachev was the first Soviet leader to kind of believe that. But the fact is, at Reykjavik, it wasn't no nuclear didn't come from Gorbachev. It came from Ronald Reagan. The transcript is quite clear on that. The notes are quite clear that Reagan comes up with the idea. And Gorbachev says, well, I guess I can buy onto that. But it's Reagan is the pusher. And I don't know about Richard, but I never suspected that Reagan was so anti-nuclear. And it turns out he really, really was. The last point I would make is on why Reykjavik was a failure, despite what came from it, from arms control, from the no-nuclear movement, and thirdly, from the breakup of the Soviet Union. It was a failure because on Sunday morning, unlike on Saturday night, when we had all these reductions on strategic arms, Sunday morning, Gorbachev surprised all of us with two things. Neither expected. But nothing was expected there, to tell you the truth. Sunday morning, he announced that, yes, they could go to zero on INF systems in Europe, which all of us said, holy cow. This had never come up before, without counting British and French. And number two, all the strategic gains we had made all night were tied to agreeing to SDI in the laboratory. That was never discussed at night at all, but this was his idea of trying to get that done. So it was good news on the INF front, disastrous news on the strategic front, unless you went along with confining INF to the laboratory. And that's what sent Sunday into a total tailspin.
Well, thanks very much, Ken. I think you might have actually run the risk of going a little bit too far in all of your vivid descriptions because, you know, you're leaving not too much for the book. Hopefully there's a lot more in there because I think you've really given us a feel. I felt like I was in a blow-by-blow of the whole summit there. Strobe and Marvin, I'm sure you've got some comments on this. Just one quick thing on the war scare. We actually do know that the Soviet Union was pretty freaked out by all of this, just to you know, put it very bluntly. because there's an awful lot of material that has now been released from Soviet archives. In fact, a lot of it is in open source on the websites from the CIA and the Institute of Intelligence Security Studies. And some of those include the archives of the famous East German spymaster Marcus Wolf, who reports on how his KGB and Soviet counterparts were constantly hounding him for looking for any kinds of signs that the perfidious capitalists in the West might be preparing for a nuclear war. So although, as you say, they still had all of their planes and ships out there in plain sight, they were constantly scouring for any piece of evidence that the United States might be preparing for a nuclear war. And again, we can see all that material out there. It might not have seemed so at the time, but now we know, 30 years on, that was actually
I'm not questioning that the material existed. I'm questioning whether it was sincere.
Well, I think there's an awful lot of people who do believe it was sincere.
Right, but why don't they actually take some action to show that this could happen?
If
everybody was saying in my neighborhood, there are a lot of robbers around here. You got to be careful around here. You got to be careful because the robbers are up around here. You know what I do? I lock my door.
Well, the Soviet Union actually did do something like that. They launched their own operation at the time, again, in the files. I don't want to turn this into a kind of a back and forth on this particular issue, because I do think it's very important, just to get to the of Reykjavik, that it was really ending a period where there was real, genuine fears of a nuclear war, which you said yourself said certainly in the West, but it was just as real in the Soviet Union. So this is what I think makes this such an important summit. And Stroop, I mean, the questions, about where Reykjavik led, I think are very important. And I know you've got something to say on this as well.
I think within 5 minutes or so, we're going to turn to the future. And I don't want to rekindle the argument about the past. But I do want to put, as it were, on the table for this discussion, a very important piece of background that goes back even before your preface. And that is, one of the reasons for the neuralgia of the Soviet Union about a robust anti-ballistic missile system was that we, the United States, in the person of Lyndon Johnson, had to beat Alexei Kosygin over the head at the Glasgow summit on why the seemingly perverse principle that defense is bad and defense is destabilizing is actually a critical way of, or is critical to the U.S. position for a long time that we had to limit our anti-ballistic missile systems. Mm-hmm. And the Soviets bought that. I think while President Reagan sincerely believed that that was either out of date or just plain wrong, many of his advisors, including some who were there with him in Reykjavik, just didn't believe, A, that SDI would be stabilizing, and B, that it would work. And that was part of the background.
Marvin.
Just quickly, my sense is that the Russians were concerned about SDI in the sense they tried to head off the sudden appearance of an SDI system. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that this was something that could have been developed over time. Their concern was what was really in the mind of the Americans at this point. It's interesting to bear in mind, I mentioned before Afghanistan, taking place at roughly the same time. Russia was at that point losing the war. That was obvious to the Russians and the rest of the world. And what did the U.S. do at that point? Make it easy for the Russians to lose or make it more difficult? The latter, an investment of $10 billion in armaments to build up the Mujahideen, who today, as you all know, are among our best friends in Afghanistan. A point also about the SDI. Where is the SDI today? Anybody keep track of SDIs?
Yeah.
Huge, important issue, right? Right? My sense is that if I go back to a point, but I have to go back to it because it means a lot to me and they to you. If these two men actually discussed and they did, the elimination of all nuclear weapons with a time frame of the year 2000. And at the end of the day, you couldn't do it because of the difference in whether laboratory or out in the air testing of SDI, a system which since then has meant nothing, nothing whatever in the U.S.-Soviet relationship, or for that matter, in terms of arming the world for an Armageddon. And Reagan was the one who used that term Armageddon, by the way, in 1983. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of in his mind, and in the 84 presidential debate, I in fact asked him about that. And he sort of backed off and made the point again and again, a nuclear war cannot be won and ought not to be fought. Mm-hmm. He was very much opposed to it, but he couldn't quite bring himself at the end of the day to take that extra step on SDI. And historically, and forgive me for going back to my disappointment, that to me stands out as a huge moment when we could have gone one way but ended up going another.
Well, thanks, Marvin. I think in the next panel we'll be taking this discussion somewhat further because, of course, there's been the issue not of SDI per se, but certainly of missile defense.
Yep.
That has certainly come up during two other administrations of Bush and Obama that has also colored, in many respects, the relationship between Russia and the United States. I'd like to bring in the audience just quickly for a couple of questions, because we are going to pick up these questions in more detail in the second panel. Over here, please. I'll just take two or three and then we'll come back for some more comments. So if you could just identify yourself. Thank you.
Hello, Steve Wallace. I'm retired from the U.S. government. I remember after the Reykjavik, the Economist ran a cover showing Reagan and Gorbachev dressed as sort of peace demonstrators with peace signs, love beads, the whole thing, and no nuke signs. And underneath it was titled, "A Specter is Haunting Europe." And the theme of the story was abolishing strategic nuclear weapons, as I argued, would make it a higher risk that there would actually be a war in Europe, or either conventional or a limited nuclear war that would be confined to the battlefield. And then about a year later, Freddie Clay and Albert Wohlstetter published their report on discriminate deterrence, uh-huh. which gave sort of concrete expression to those fears. So what I'd like to ask is, what role did the Reykjavik summit play in raising these concerns about the credibility of extended deterrence and the heightening this sort of debate over both INF and short-range nuclear weapons in Europe during the remainder of the 1980s?
That's a great question. Thanks very much. I think Richard Pearl, obviously, was also at Reykjavik, would like to have a question or a comment. Thank you.
Just one quick point, because I think it bears on the question of how we should now regard what happened at Reykjavik. At the very last session, the session that ended without agreement, there was a proposal on the table, and it had been put in writing. And in these matters, proposals in writing have to be given precedence over the chatter that surrounds it. That proposal, which Gorbachev couldn't accept, it was an American proposal. That proposal called for eliminating all offensive ballistic missiles over a decade. And at the end of the decade, with all offensive ballistic missiles eliminated, both sides would have the right to deploy a defense if they had a defense capable of deploying. The reason why this is so important is that if you want to claim that SDI sank the summit, you have to explain what the objection to SDI would have been after the missiles that it was uniquely tailored to shoot down had been eliminated. And it was this flaw in the Soviet argument, and I had this discussion a dozen times with Shevardnadze. The Soviet side could never give an adequate explanation for why SDI was relevant in the absence of offensive nuclear weapons.
Thanks for that point. There's a lady over here and then at the front, please, and then we'll go back to the panel to wrap up.
Marwa Maziad, University of Washington. Marvin, you talked about the importance of two men coming to change the nature of the confrontation, really, but how there was a pushback from their respective militaries and the political advisor. And I think this is very important to highlight civil-military relations in both countries. Mm-hmm. If you can reflect a little bit more, the three of you, on how much there is a print for individual presidents in the United States on national security and foreign policies versus an institutional continuity that probably comes from the military having their own views of what is important, what is not important, and SDI being a case in that. If you can tell us more a little bit about what the military, having the small research program, you said, what they saw in that, or the political advisors as well, so some civil-military relations.
Thanks, Garrick. There's another question. Okay. Let me just take a few more comments because we've only got 15 minutes left. Garrick, and then I think Bob Einhorn, and then there was... okay.
Thanks very much. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report, and I want to just say, first of all, this discussion is, an important reminder of the power of oral history. Mm-hmm. Listening to the stories from the participants is powerful. This is not something I would say anybody in this auditorium is going to forget soon. And so I really can't thank you enough for that.
Stop right there. It's good.
Okay.
Why would you want to go wrong?
But Ken, I've got a list of things here that I want to just read. This is probably a rhetorical question. Let me pose it anyway. But what's so powerful to me about this, among other things, is these two people in a place called Iceland, in a very small building. Managing the future of the world in the course of a couple of days. And I say to myself, is that ever going to happen again? And can that happen in the age of Twitter, et cetera? And that's really what you have left me with. Thank you.
Well, that's a big question. I'm being told that we can have a little bit extra time here, so I'll go back to the other questions and comments and just see if there's anything, Bukadana Ostrobi, you would like to add something.
Richard, thank you very much for being here, and thank you very much for being at Reykjavik. I think you have made an important point and reminded us of why the Soviets were so scared of SDI and why they were not ready to sign up to the elimination of all ballistic missiles. They saw American technology in general and military technology in particular as a black magic that we had and they didn't. They felt inferior in their technology to thwart SDI. They never thought that they would get an SDI anywhere near as capable as the American SDI. And with regard to the prospect of eliminating ballistic missiles, that would still leave the United States with non-ballistic delivery systems, such as cruise missiles with stealth. And for years afterwards, I heard that from Russians, and I wouldn't be surprised if you did as well.
Marvin, do you want to add something?
Well, the young lady raises the point about the military budget and the role of the military. I cannot but remember President Eisenhower leaving office, making a very specific point about the power of the military-industrial complex. And here it comes from a man who was a general, who fought in a war. So he was not, he didn't catch a cold when he dealt with military people. He knew them. And yet, in terms of the relationship of the military as a power in the United States, measured up against the diplomacy and the Congress and even the president, There is an enormous strength there, and there is a kind of, not fear, but awesome respect that people have when a guy in a uniform walks in and he's got a lot of medals around him. So if two men had an opportunity, as Gary was saying before, they're sitting in this house, if two men had an opportunity to do any number of things with arms control, but one of them was the possibility of both of them addressing that single issue, then you get to a point where SDI becomes terribly important. It isn't today, but it was at that moment. And you say to yourself, what is the Russian position on this? They were ready to buy in lab, and we wanted both, lab and outside. Think about it in terms of proportionality. Think about logic. Think about the power of history and the lessons of history. I still go back to that moment, and I know that Ken will be unhappy with my saying this, but Reykjavik had very little to do with the end of the Soviet Union. The end of the Soviet Union was created by the system itself. It was dreadful. It died because it deserved to die. It had very little to do with Reykjavik. But if diplomats feel good, having participated in Reykjavik, saying, wow, we held off a fantastic Russian adventure. They might have done awful kinds of things. They were falling apart. And we should have recognized it at that time. But our intelligence was woefully inadequate on the collapse of the Soviet Union. Thank you. Ken, I love you anyway.
Well, Marvin, I was going to actually also ask you, because Steve asked this question about the credibility of deterrence after Reykjavik. I mean, what's your sense of that? With the Reykjavik and the idea, as people learned later, that there had been this move to get rid of nuclear weapons, and getting back to Richard.
Well, this business about getting, I mean, Ken mentioned all of the people who are at Reykjavik who now believe, those who are alive, that getting rid of all of the nuclear weapons really is a fantastic aim. We all ought to do that. And they are now pledged to do it. Why didn't they do it then? Why? What was it that was so important about that extra moment of SDI that you couldn't make that extra step? I still don't understand it. I don't. I'm sorry.
Well, Ken, do you understand it better now, 30 years on?
I do. And let me just start with the last point that Marvin made, because I think it's the most important point, to tell you the truth, and then get back to SDI and the talk of no nukes. The relationship between Reykjavik and the end of the Cold War, the end of the Soviet Union. Marvin makes the point that Strobe has talked about in the past, and I think it's conventional wisdom right now, that the Soviet Union collapsed of its own weight. As Marvin said, it was a lousy system. They were very poor. It had to collapse. Why did it have to collapse? We've had poor countries for a long time. They don't collapse. Carol and I lived in Africa for 2.5 years. Go around from country to country. They're not collapsed. North Korea is now on its, 85th year? People are eating grass and bark. There's no revolution there, unfortunately. It's not collapsed. Cuba has been under the Castro since 1959. Gets poorer and poorer. There's no collapse right there. Gibbons ends his Rise and Fall of the Third of the Roman Empire with a wonderful line. This intolerable situation lasted only another 300 years. It was intolerable. It was bankrupt. And it lasted 300 years. Okay. When you look at the data, too, that what was going on in the Soviet Union then. Now, this I'm going to open up a whole can of worms of controversy here, but the CIA estimates in 1986, at the time of Reykjavik, was that the Soviet economy was growing at 2.5%. Okay? Now you can say, Marvin, I know what you're going to say.
Oh, that's my point.
Okay. They could have been wrong.
We're in left field.
Okay, they could have been wrong. They could have been right. It wasn't desperately wrong estimate. People weren't making fun of it at the time. Maybe you were. But, it was thought to be respectable that they were growing. You can talk about the ruble-dollar conversion all you want, And that's a very hard thing of knowing how much it would have cost them to build the military, and there's a whole wilderness of data on that. But I think the CIA was better doing relative prosperity, relative decline of the Soviet Union during those years than it was U.S.-Soviet comparison. And anyway, the CIA was reporting in 86, 87, until the reforms really got underway, that there was a growth between 2.5, and then it jumped to 4%, and then it came down to 2 and 1% of growth. But this was not precipitous decline. This was not depression. This was not one-third reduction. And at least in terms of, again, the CIA estimate of per capita wealth in the Soviet Union, Soviet citizens, at that time it was higher than where Americans go to vacation every year. It was higher than Israel. It was higher than Italy. It was higher than Ireland. It had a per capita income of $8,000 or something like that. So this idea that the Soviet Union was so poor and so out of it and getting poorer all the time, and empires that are real, real poor have to have a revolution, have to have a total disillusion like the Soviet Union, I just don't buy. And I don't think that you can see any evidence in history. The Ottoman Empire lasted years and decades and in decline. People decline, and they go on in decline.
So why did it break up?
It broke up because Gorbachev wanted to compete with the United States in terms of technology, and just what you said, there was no way the high tech of SDI could be matched by anything in the Soviet system, and therefore he had to change the incentive and he had to change the way the whole system operated. And that's perestroika, as Marvin said, that is glasnost. Perestroika was a mess because he could not imagine how you reform, and I don't blame him, to tell you the truth. At that time, we had about 30 countries who had gone from communism to capitalism, but not one country had gone from capitalism to communism, but not one country had ever gone from communism to capitalism. There was no roadmap for something like that. He wanted, as Marvin says, communism with a human face, just like Dubček in 1968. There was no communism with a human face. Perestroika was a mess, that he had no clear idea of this path. Glasnost was a raging success, and much to his detriment. It was a raging success because they opened up, as he said, the closed pages of our past. And when you open up the closed pages of Soviet past, you have two big headlights right in your face. One is called Lenin and one is called Stalin, and neither one is very pretty at all.
Yeah, I hate to intervene, but I feel actually I have to. And actually, unfortunately, intervention is one of the reasons that the Soviet Union collapsed. You've got actually on your last picture here that isn't on the board, but is on the slide, which we might be able to put up. A reference to Yeltsin, to Boris Yeltsin. I mean, Strobe is a man who's written a considerable number of books and articles on Boris Yeltsin, as others have, and you've actually got several people sitting here in the audience who are scholars of Russia and the former Soviet Union who were shaking their heads as you were beginning to speak. Because one of the precipitating events, there's always a precipitating event that brings something down, was really a decision, first of all, by a group, including Akhramiev, who you mentioned, to launch a coup against Gorbachev, not because of anything that he did related to Reykjavik, but because he was trying to have a new union treaty, which would have decentralized the Soviet Union. And then a decision by Boris Yeltsin and a number of other Republican leaders within the Soviet Union, but mostly Boris Yeltsin, to actually get rid of the Soviet Union behind the scenes.
I agree with that.
Now, they made those decisions for all kinds of different reasons. I'd like to try to get us, you know, to get back to Reykjavik, because I do think it played something of a role, because many people in the military and elsewhere weren't very happy about Gorbachev negotiating with the United States in such an open, frank way, as well as many other things that Gorbachev was doing. And, you know, Gorbachev resigned. He signed himself, as it says on your sheet, into history, but others also signed him into history with a palace coup, or two palace coups, in fact, behind the scenes.
Thank you for mentioning the coup attempt. I think that was very
important. I think what I'd like to do very quickly, because there was a couple of other important people in the audience, including Bob Einhorn, who's been very much steeped in arms control, want to say something. So I just want to bring in the last couple of people, gentlemen here and one here, who I'd like, just like to bring back, and then let's close and get into the next
panel.
Fiona.
I'm Thanks, Bob Einhorn from Brookings. Ken, could you tell us a bit about the reaction of President Reagan's principal advisors to what was on the table? Richard Perle, suggested that the delegation tried to come up with variants that probably some of the strategically minded advisors thought would be less destabilizing and more advantageous to the United States than simply giving up all nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Bob. Gentlemen here, so we'll get the microphone back to you. Are you getting two microphones?
Too much. I was a young Italian Moscow correspondent in Reykjavik. In your very interesting discussion, you didn't mention Margaret Thatcher, mm-hmm. François Mitterrand, Helmut Kohl, Giulio Andreotti, and all the Western European. They were very seriously enemies of any kind of miracle in Reykjavik. Maybe they were much more conservative than General Akromeyev. I remember, and they were conservative to any change of the system in Europe at that time. I just remember Giulio Andreotti, that 2 years after, he said that we love so much Germany that we do prefer to have two Germanys rather than one. So could you put on the framework also the European that they wanted to keep the nuclear? Thank you.
That's a very good point. And then the gentleman just behind you, and then we'll come back to the panel. It's the last question. Thank you.
One, thank you so much for a very stimulating discussion. Bob Shadler, American Foreign Policy Council. One of the things that kind of came to mind with the discussion was how much people got it wrong throughout. And at the time, I was at the U.S. Information Agency, and the job we had was to explain to foreign publics who Reagan was and what he was trying to do and what Reykjavik was all about. And it also has, I guess I'm trying to connect the dots of this year, where it seems every intelligent, informed person has been wrong about most everything regarding domestic politics. So it shouldn't be surprising that most everybody, including Reagan's closest aides and his worst enemies in the press and elsewhere, got things pretty much wrong, both about what Reagan wanted to do and what was going to be the result of Reykjavik. I just ask for some reflections on how kind of the informed audiences should try to screen out the quick impressions of people who are very close to what's going on and highly intelligent and informed as they try to inform the rest of us in the way that USIA, when it existed, was supposed to do. And how should we try to screen out what is going to be terribly wrong, such as how long the Soviet Union is going to exist. I happen to have a very thick volume of testimony in early 1989 before Congress of almost all the Russian experts. Almost nobody saw a glimmer of its demise.
Well, thank you. That's a very important last question. As a student at that point, I decided to do a master's in Soviet studies. I was very upset in December of 1991 when my newly minted degree that Marvin once also had in Martin Service had just disappeared on me. After that, I decided it was always best to study history. Strobe, on the European front, as our colleague who was also there from Italy noted, there was quite a different view on the part of the Europeans, and I'm sure they would not have been very happy about the Saturday morning, or rather the Sunday morning proposals on Europe.
Yeah, just a sentence. You're absolutely right. We all remember it who were there and traveling in Europe at the time. Had the deal gone through, our European allies would have seen basically the nuclear deterrent posed by the United States collapse. That simple. As for your speculative question, I've occasionally, particularly in preparation for this conversation, gone back and seen how close actually it did come on several occasions, including I can imagine the Soviets actually picking up the second to last American proposal that might have, if the president had allowed it, if Reagan had allowed it, to keep the ABM treaty, say, in place for another 10 years while SDI was developed. Imagine what the world would be like now if that had gone through. And by the way, there would have been a great deal of angst on the part of our allies and our nuclear priesthood. But the two presidents had the ability to sign a treaty like that, and it would have been the fact with a whole other set of anxieties and controversies different from the ones that we're dealing with here.
It's a fascinating question, Strobe. If they had signed it, and the French and the British had established that they wanted their independent nuclear force, so what would we have done? It would have been very difficult to persuade them. But that idea that the two big boys sign it, then how does the rest of the world adjust to that signature? And would they have objected and done all kinds of horrific things? Maybe. The likelihood is they would have come on board eventually. But these things happen in stages. The gentleman who raised the question about how you get this information out, keep reading history, because you're not going to get it up front very often. You get headlines, and that's what we journalists do. We provide headlines, and we do it day by day, and after a while, actually, we do describe what has happened, but it's with perspective that you really can pick up things and biography. And what do these two men really think? The Gorbachev story is still one. Having read his book and books about him, I still have a feeling there's a great book there to be done.
And by the way, if Gorbachev had accepted Reagan's proposal, Akhramayev would have gotten on a separate plane and flown back to Moscow, and you would have had the palace coup then. Maybe.
Well, we're going to talk about, I think, also third nuclear powers in the next panel. Our colleague Steve Pfeiffer has written an article about that recently. It's still out there playing as an issue. And, of course, we have now the North Korea dimension that was not on the agenda at Reykjavik. I'd like to thank our panelists very much for their time. Ken, in particular, for giving us really just the most spirited and vivid recollection of the period. Again, your book is outside. I hope you've left plenty of other stories for us to read in the book. And good luck with your trip to Reykjavik. I'm sure the ambassador and his colleagues will be putting on a good reception for you there. And are you going to get a chance to stay another night in the Hertie House?
Yeah, yeah.
Come back and let us know who it's haunted by. It would kind of be interesting to find out that dimension. And thank you very much, obviously,
thank
to
you.
Marvin Strobe for also giving us their real-time recollections. And I hope that people will get coffee and come back for the next session, which is going to take the story onwards, right up to the present day. This story never really stops.
Right. I think the house is going to be haunted by Gorbachev and Reagan.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you. Thanks for all.
Well done.
Thanks,
yeah. Second panel, ladies and gentlemen. We had a very interesting and enlightening first panel. I'm Angela Stent. I'm the director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University and also a senior non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. And I have to say, I'm very tempted, before we get into the question about what's happened since the collapse of the Soviet Union, to make two brief remarks about 1986. One of them is, or maybe looking forward, when Gorbachev, on the question of why the Soviet Union collapsed, when Gorbachev came to the United States in the early 1990s after the Soviet collapse, he gave a talk at the Library of Congress, and
Jim Billington, who was then the Librarian of Congress, said, "What was your biggest mistake?" And he said, "I underestimated the nationalities problem." So I do want to come back to what Fiona Hill said at the end. The proximate cause of the collapse of the Soviet Union was the inability to work out an agreement between the center and the different republics of the Soviet Union. And that was related certainly to glasnost and to perestroika, but that was the thing in the end that brought the Soviet Union down. And the other brief reminiscence about 1986 to show how Gorbachev had already been through a major transformation before he met President Reagan in Reykjavik was I arrived in the Soviet Union in Moscow 3 days before the Chernobyl accident. I had a fellowship for 1 month at the Institute for World Economy and International Relations, and I had with me a one-year-old son, and that's relevant to what I'm going to say about Chernobyl. So I had been there 2 days. I'm listening to the BBC radio, and then I realized that some catastrophe has happened in terms of a nuclear accident. And the next week, a few days later, I gave a talk at the Institute, and I was trying to be forward-leaning and talking about the importance of improving U.S.-Soviet relations. And the person who hosted me, the chair of my panel, then started attacking me for the quote-unquote the lies that the United States was telling about Chernobyl. There had been no accident. No one had been killed. So that was one version of it. And by the way, after my talk, I had people privately come up to me and say, you know, what's really going on? Anyway, in the three subsequent weeks, Gorbachev had a complete turnaround. After, first of all, denying that something had happened, he went on television. He admitted that something had happened. Unfortunately, by then it was too late for some of the children, for instance, who'd been playing soccer on May the 1st in radioactive dust places in Kiev and other places in Ukraine. Anyway, just before I left the Soviet Union, on my last day, the very man who had attacked me when I gave my talk at IMMO came up to me and said, you know, thank you very much for being here. A terrible tragedy has happened, and we have to work together. We have to cooperate, the United States and the Soviet Union, to make sure that this doesn't happen again. So this was really a transformative moment. And unfortunately, when you hear some of the things that emanate today from the Kremlin about who's responsible for what in the world and the downing of the Malaysian airline and everything else that's happening, it sounds a little reminiscent of what it was like in 1986 before Gorbachev admitted what had happened at Chernobyl. Anyway, so I think the first point I wanted to make, having listened to this fascinating panel, is Reykjavik, even though we know that it didn't succeed completely, it was obviously the beginning of a very important process. And something like that, it's hard to imagine that something like that could happen today, because it was so much based also on the personal relationship between these two leaders who, despite all their differences, got on rather well. And we're obviously at a point today where U.S.-Russian relations are worse than they've been since before Gorbachev came to power. And obviously the personal relations between the two presidents are almost, I would say, poisonous, but they're very negative relations. And of course, we know that yesterday, and Fiona Hill again mentioned this briefly in her introduction, the Kremlin announced, President Putin announced, that Russia was withdrawing from this agreement that it had with the United States on the disposal of weapons-grade plutonium. The United States was, of course, blamed for that. Putin, when he announced this, said that the reason Russia was doing it is, and I'm quoting now, the emergence of a threat to strategic stability and as a result of unfriendly actions by the United States of America against the Russian Federation. And he's now tied Russia rejoining this plutonium agreement to three conditions. And one of them is that NATO should withdraw forces which are in Russia's neighborhood. We've been beefing up our forces, obviously, because of what's happened in Ukraine. Secondly, we have to end the sanctions that were imposed after Russia annexed Crimea and then launched a war in the Donbas region. And then thirdly, Congress has to abrogate the Magnitsky Act. And this, again, I think shows a continuing lack of understanding in the Kremlin about the separation of powers in the United States or how our system works. Anyway, those are three conditions which mean that, they won't be met, obviously, so that Russia will now have withdrawn from this agreement. So the purpose of our panel today is to ask, why has it been so challenging since the Soviet collapse to reach and then maintain and increase arms control agreements between the United States and Russia? You would have thought that with the collapse of communism, the end of the Soviet Union, it would have been easier to reach such agreements. And as has been pointed out, in every presidency since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the presidents have started out rather hopeful about arms control agreements. And in the second terms, if we're not talking about now the George H.W. Bush administration, but in the second terms of Clinton, George W. Bush, and Obama, these arms control agreements have really stagnated. They've been frozen, and they haven't been able to proceed. And this is tied to a broader, you know, theme, which is that in the past 25 years, each American president has come into office, or in George H.W. Bush's case, he was already in office, seeking to improve relations with Russia. There have been four different resets, trying to have a more productive relationship. All of these have ended in disappointment, because obviously we have a very different understanding of what a productive relationship with Russia would look like. What has worked in the past 25 years have been issues where Russia feels that we're treating it as an equal, and where it feels that its interests are respected, and where our interests and those of Russia, rather narrowly defined, have coincided. One of those has been what happened in the fall of 2001, the cooperation with Russia in the first phase of the war in Afghanistan and the initial defeat of the Taliban, where the Russians were very helpful and really cooperated with the U.S. because we had very much a common goal. And there are some more examples. U.S.-Russian cooperation in disarming Syria of its chemical weapons in 2013, the discussions we had that finally led to the agreement on Iran, and the arms control agreements, because in arms control in general, this is a field, a sphere, where the U.S. and Russia deal with each other as equals. We are the two nuclear superpowers, and Russia usually feels that it is being respected as a world player because we come to the table as equals. So all the more reason to question why it's been so difficult to complete and to sustain these arms control agreements. Now, we have two excellent speakers. We couldn't have any better speakers to discuss that with us today. I'll be turning first to Steve Rademacher. He's a principal in the Podesta Group. He's a former Assistant Secretary of State dealing with arms control issues in the George W. Bush administration. He's also worked on Capitol Hill, a rich experience in dealing with these issues. And then, of course, Brookings' own Stephen Pfeiffer, former ambassador to Ukraine, having dealt at various levels in the State Department and the National Security Council with arms control issues. He is, of course, a senior fellow at Brookings, and he's the director of the Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative, and has written widely on all of these issues, and I'm sure that he will have a great deal to say about all of this. So I'm just going to say a few words about the background to when George W. Bush came into the White House, about what had happened during the Clinton administration in terms of arms control agreements, and then we can move on to see what happened since then. So when President Bill Clinton took office in January of 1993, he inherited two nuclear arms control agreements from the George H.W. Bush administration, START 1 and START 2. And we heard a little bit about the background of them in the previous panel. START 1 reduced each side to no more than 6,000 strategic warheads on 1,600 strategic nuclear delivery vehicles. And START 2, which had just been completed before the first President Bush left office, went further. It reduced each side to no more than 3,000 to 3,500 strategic warheads. And also from the U.S. perspective, very importantly, it was supposed to ban all heavy ICBMs and all ICBMs with multiple warheads. Now, START 1's entry into force was then held up by an issue that we're reminded of very much today again, and that was the question of Ukraine and its readiness to give up its own nuclear weapons. So, of course, when the Soviet Union collapsed, Ukraine was the third largest nuclear country in the world, and the Clinton administration, and before it, the George H.W. Bush administration, worked very hard on trying to ensure that Russia would become the only nuclear successor state on the post-Soviet space. And that involved Ukraine, also Belarus and Kazakhstan, but mainly Ukraine, being willing to transfer their nuclear weapons to Russia. Anyway, I give great kudos to the Clinton administration. They managed to do it. Both Ukraine and Russia were ambivalent, were reluctant for different reasons, and they signed the agreement in 1994. But of course, that was tied to the infamous by now Budapest Memorandum, which gave Ukraine assurances that if it relinquished its nuclear weapons, its territorial integrity would be guaranteed. And it had security assurances from the signatories, which of course included the Russian Federation. In 1996, the Senate finally ratified the START II agreement. But then there were problems with Moscow. So this is now a tale in the 1990s of the difficulties of implementing these agreements because of the deteriorating political relationship. And particularly in the latter part of the 90s, the Russian military was not happy about giving up on the multiple warhead and heavy ICBMs. And then, of course, you had the beginnings of the disagreements with Russia about NATO enlargement in the latter part of the 1990s. And then, of course, in 1999, with the NATO actions against Serbia over Kosovo with a bombing, etc. And so the Duma then delayed ratification of the agreement. So the Duma finally did ratify START II in 2000, but it tied it, and this is where we come back to Star Wars, and I know we're going to hear more about the son of Star Wars or son of SDI missile defense, but where the Duma then tied it to saying that the Senate had to ratify the 1997 agreement on the ABM systems, the anti-ballistic missile systems. START II, then, which had been ratified, which had been signed into law by President George H.W. Bush, was then pulled back by Vladimir Putin when the United States announced that it was unilaterally withdrawing from the ABM treaty at the beginning of 2002. So by then, of course, you have all these missile defense issues which are now intruding on the arms control agenda. So with that brief background, I'm going to turn to you, Steve Rademacher, and we will look forward to your discussion of arms control in the George W. Bush administration and whether you have views about why discussions on arms control did or didn't impact on the ability of the United States to cooperate with Russia on other issues, too.
Okay. Well, thank you, Angela, and thank you for inviting me. I guess I want to throw an idea on the table before I actually get into my discussion of the Bush administration. In 2009, I wrote an op-ed that was published in the Wall Street Journal. They gave it the title, Why Democrats Fail at Arms Control. That was their title, not mine. But what the issue that I looked at was this paradox that by reputation, Republicans are deeply skeptical of arms control, and Democrats are deeply enthusiastic. And yet, if you look at the history of bilateral strategic arms control between the United States and the Soviet Union and now Russia, the scorecard is kind of astonishing. Republican presidents have a lot of accomplishments they can point to. And when I wrote that article in 2009, it was the case that no Democratic president had negotiated or had ever negotiated and brought into force a strategic arms control agreement with the Soviet Union or Russia. And why is that? I mean, how can it be that the guys who are skeptical seem to have a lot more success at this than the guys who are so enthusiastic? And you can offer theories. One theory would be, some of the Democrats have had bad luck. And I think maybe with Jimmy Carter, it's not his fault that the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. So maybe you can excuse his inability to bring about the ratification of START II. But in my article, I sort of put forward a different theory, which was that, it's kind of common sense among people, among all of us, that in a negotiation, and we negotiate in our personal lives all the time, excessive enthusiasm usually is not conducive to getting the result that you want in a negotiation. Pick any. You're buying a car. even if you find a car that you really want, or I guess I should say especially if you find a car that you really want, I think you all know the last thing you want to do is convey to the seller that you've made up your mind, it's that car and no other. Because, you know, if you convey that, if the seller becomes aware that your demand curve for that car has become really inelastic, what happens? The price goes up, the negotiation becomes prolonged because the seller thinks, I'm not going to leave any money on the table. I've got somebody here who's going to be really enthusiastic about this car. I'm going to get as much out of this transaction as I can. And, I mean, that's just common sense in our personal, you know, business transactions. For some reason, I think some of our presidents, not just Democrats, I mean, I think George H.W. Bush, for example, in the Chemical Weapons Convention was a little too enthusiastic and ended up getting a bad deal too. But for some reason, many of our presidents have failed to translate what is common sense in, you know, any sort of business transaction we might negotiate at a personal level. They don't understand that the same applies between nations. And in negotiating with the Russians, you know, conveying excessive enthusiasm can actually backfire. That was my thesis in this piece that I wrote. And of course, that was in 2009. Now, you know, President Obama did succeed in 2010 in negotiating his arms control treaty with Russia. Though I would say that I would argue that negotiation became prolonged again because of excessive enthusiasm on his side. But with that background, I want to turn to the Bush administration, which has been accused of many things, but never been accused of excessive enthusiasm for arms control. So, what was the record of the Bush administration? As an administration that came to office, more or less committed to abolishing the ABM treaty because it had become an obstacle to the deployment of missile defenses. And also, given the security environment, that existed at that point, committed to reductions in nuclear force levels, but not at all committed to the idea that this needed to be negotiated and you know, agreed between the United States and Russia. And first thing that the administration did was in December of 2001, it abrogated or provided notice of termination of the ABM treaty. Now, for approximately the preceding decade, every single issue of the magazine Arms Control Today had run an editorial about how the ABM treaty was the cornerstone of strategic stability, that without the ABM treaty, the entire architecture of arms control as we know it would collapse, that the inevitable result would be a new arms race between the United States and Russia. So in December 2001, this theory was put to a test. Bush provided notice of termination. 5 months later, he signed an arms control treaty with Moscow, providing for reductions, I think, the force level under the nuclear force level under the existing START treaty was 6,000 warheads per side. It was reduced to no more than 2,200 under the Moscow treaty, or it's sometimes called the SORT treaty. So, I mean, first of all, this theory that without the ABM treaty you couldn't have arms control was disproven within 5 months because actually arms control had its first, I mean, there was the first successful strategic arms control negotiation between the United States and Russia in more than 10 years that took place in the wake of abrogation of the ABM treaty. But I think also the background to the Moscow treaty is interesting because it was not your traditional arms control negotiation. I mean, what happened was the Bush administration did an internal review, a nuclear posture review, and determined a new nuclear force level that it thought was appropriate in the security environment, and announced unilaterally that the United States was going to reduce its nuclear forces to this new level. And the Russians at that point basically came knocking on the door and said, but, you know, we're very happy that you're reducing your nuclear forces. We're glad that you're doing that. But we really need a treaty. And because it's very important to us psychologically to lock in these reductions and make them mutual. And true to its complete lack of enthusiasm for arms control, the reaction of the Bush administration was, no, we don't need a treaty. It's really just not important to us. And the Russians, no, it's really important to us. We really want this treaty. And so basically the Bush administration said, well, look, if it's that important to you, I guess we could sign a treaty. But, you know, here's what it's going to have to say, because we're, you know, we're just not interested in years of negotiation and, you know, wrapping in all these other issues. This is kind of it. Take it or leave it. You know, we'll sign this. And, you know, the arms control industry mocked the SORT treaty, the New START treaty. I think somebody actually printed it on the front and back of an index card to show how bare bones it was, because it was a really short treaty, unlike, you know, START and, you know, the New START, which, you know, run to thousands of pages with their annexes. This was a treaty you could print on an index card, but it did require reductions by both sides to no more than 2,200 operationally deployed strategic nuclear weapons. So it was interesting that confronted with an administration that was basically indifferent to whether we got an arms control agreement or not, suddenly the Russians were not the obstacle to an agreement. They were essentially insisting on agreement. And the U.S. was in the position of saying, well, okay, but it's got to be on these terms. And in the end, the Russians said yes to those terms. So it was actually the first success in arms control in more than 10 years. And maybe in the Q&A we can talk about why the Clinton administration wasn't, I mean, it didn't necessarily want a you know, very large U.S. nuclear force. It was prepared to do reductions too. But it had some problems getting agreement with Russia on what it wanted to do. It basically got itself completely wrapped around the axle on trying to preserve the ABM treaty. And the Russians took advantage of that to bollocks up any effort to negotiate arms control agreements during the Clinton administration. It was only by terminating the ABM treaty that the ground was cleared such that a bilateral arms control agreement was possible. Now, you know, that's how we started in the Bush administration. Things, you know, as you suggested, Angela, things kind of went downhill, especially toward the second term. And I think there were a whole bunch of issues at work there. Paul Saunders over at the Center for the National Interest did a very interesting paper on sort of where did things go wrong. You know, I was actually astonished. He interviewed lots of Russians. Mm-hmm. That, you know, like near the top of the list of Russian complaints about the Bush administration was the Kozak memorandum.
Yeah.
I mean, I could ask for a show of hands. How many people here know what the Kozak memorandum is? But, you know, so it was an effort to resolve the disagreement in Moldova about Russian armed forces in Moldova. And the Russians were deeply embittered by the way the Bush administration handled that. So I know the traditional answers are, NATO enlargement, the decision to deploy missile defenses in Poland, supporting the Georgian government under Saakashvili. These are the traditional answers, but it's actually much more complex than that, because an important part of the puzzle is the Kozak memorandum, believe it or not. So I think it became difficult to maintain that momentum, and I think it had a lot to do with President Putin and his effort to return Russia to something like the role that it had played in the past. But anyway, maybe I'll stop there and
okay.
Keep talking.
Thank you. Steve, you want to take up the story?
Sure. We'll save the Kozak memorandum for the Q&A. I think if you look at how arms control has played in the Obama administration and its relationship with Russia over the last eight years, I guess I'd say there were sort of three phases. And the first phase was the reset from 2009 to 2011. And it was pretty clear that when Barack Obama became president, I mean, he actually wanted to do something big on nuclear weapons. And we saw that in the speech in Prague in April of 2009, where he embraced the goal of a world without nuclear weapons, also being a bit realistic and said, look, this may not happen in my lifetime. As long as there are nuclear weapons, we have to have a deterrent that's secure, that's safe and reliable. But in some ways, I think he's actually, if you're going back to the first panel, you know, Obama and Reagan were the ones who I think had a passionate belief about really doing something significant about getting rid of nuclear weapons. You had in those first months, and Marcy Reese is here, who helped negotiate it, the New START Treaty, early progress on New START, so that when the president went to Moscow in July of 2009 to meet with then-President Medvedev, they already had the guidelines for what a New START treaty would look like. And that reflected, I think, a return to a more traditional approach that the Russians were more comfortable with. I mean, complaints that I heard about the Bush administration when I was out of government talking to Russians, they said, yes, we understand the American desire to limit warheads only, but you limit deployed warheads, you don't limit reserve warheads and you don't limit missiles and bombers, and how does that not create a huge breakout potential? And so I think the Russians were more comfortable when the Obama administration indicated early on that it was prepared to go back to that more traditional approach of limiting both warheads, but also strategic delivery vehicles, missiles, and bombers. And in that early months, New START had a boost from RESET, but I think also New START gave a boost to RESET. I mean, early progress was good for the broader U.S.-Russia relationship. I'd make just a comment on RESET. I'm in the group that still thinks actually RESET was a success. I think we're a small and decreasing number of people. I see it as a success in terms of what I understood its original purpose was, which was not to get the U.S.-Russia relationship to nirvana, but to get out of a hole that we were in with Russia in 2008 and get the Russians to be doing things that the Obama administration early on defined as in U.S. interest. So it was a strategic nuclear arms reduction agreement. It was more Russian help on ending the Iranian nuclear program, and it was Russian help on Afghanistan, logistics in terms of getting supplies and forces easier to Afghanistan. And on those areas in the first couple of years, the Obama administration, I think, can look back and say it achieved important things. Now, by 2011, maybe May or June of 2011, it was pretty clear the RESET had run its course. You know, maybe they should have declared RESET a success and come up with a new term, and then that term would have failed. But looking after the New START Treaty, it was also very clear, and the president made this public, you know, he wanted to go beyond New START and not only negotiate further cuts in strategic weapons, but also bring in non-strategic nuclear weapons. And so for the first time, this idea that you might have a U.S.-Russia negotiation that was looking at everything. And then early on, you begin to see the Russians, I think, held back. And trying to figure out why is an interesting question, and we can speculate. It was pretty clear the Russians were content with New START, and at least at that point in time, were not prepared to go beyond it. I think part of the reason was the Russians look at nuclear weapons as political tools above and beyond their strategic value, and it gets into Moscow's self-perception of Russia as a superpower, and really the only way that they can compete in the world and claim superpower status is lots of nuclear weapons. Another part of it is, and this may be changing, but certainly in 2010, the Russians still saw themselves with significant gaps vis-a-vis NATO and other conventional military forces, and they saw nuclear weapons as part of the answer to that gap, which, of course, was NATO's policy during much of the Cold War. Part of it also was missile defense. And there's a conversation that came up in the first panel about just how much the Russians feared SDI. And I was actually posted at the embassy in Moscow from 1986 to 1988. And when I got there, you would talk to Soviets about SDI. There really was this palpable fear that in 10 years, the Americans are going to put us out of the ballistic missile business. That American it's really kind of interesting how much faith the Soviets and the Russians have in American technology. Now, I think in 87, people like Roald Sagdeyev, who was then the head of the Space Research Institute and a close advisor to Gorbachev, began saying, look, boss, this is really rocket science. It's hard to do. And as the leadership in Moscow understood that, that, I think, made possible the delinking that you saw where the Soviets were prepared to go and do the INF Treaty and then do the START 1 Treaty when there was really no give on the American side on defense and space questions. But I think that faith in American technology on missile defense still applies today. And I go back to a comment made by a Russian deputy prime minister when he was talking about the European phased adaptive approach. And he says, yes, phases 1, 2, and 3 aren't a problem, but we know there's going to be a phase 4, 5, 6, and 7. And so there is, I think, in Moscow, this fear that somehow the Americans are going to be clever enough to come up with something on the missile defense side that really will change the equation. But on missile defense, one of the interesting things was it actually started out as fairly a positive issue between Washington and Moscow. In September of 2009, the Obama administration announced a reconfiguration of missile defense plans for Europe, replaced the Bush plan with the European phased adaptive approach. And originally, that seemed to be win approval in Moscow. I mean, it seemed in 2009 that missile defense had been diffused as a U.S.-Russian issue. And so at the end of 2010, you even had a NATO-Russia summit. Medvedev met with NATO leaders, and they agreed, let's see if we can come up with a cooperative NATO-Russia defense for Europe. And in early 2011, what I heard from both American and Russian participants was there was actually a lot of convergence in thinking. They agreed, for one, there can't be a single system because NATO doesn't want to work for Russia and Russia doesn't work for NATO. But you have two systems that would interact through some jointly manned centers. One would be a data fusion center where you'd take early warning data from NATO sensors and from Russian sensors, bring it together, combine it, and then send the enhanced product back to both sides. And then a second center, a planning and operations center, would talk about what's the threat to Europe and how do you deal with it. But kind of in parallel with this, though, the Russians then also began talking about they wanted a legal guarantee, a treaty that American missile defenses would not be oriented against Russian strategic forces. And then they said, well, and it has to have objective criteria. And when you ask, what are these objective criteria? Well, we want limits on numbers, velocities, locations. I mean, it really was a resurrection of the ABM treaty. Hmm. And the Obama administration didn't even pursue that, recognizing that there was no chance that that kind of treaty would have a winning consent to ratification on the Hill. And so then I think in 2000, you begin with that second period where arms control begins to drift a bit. You see the Russian position on missile defense begin to harden. And then the Russians begin to bring in other questions. They say, we can talk about nuclear reductions, but there has to be a solution on missile defense. We have to deal with advanced conventional strike weapons, conventional arms control in Europe, third country nuclear forces. And they begin to sort of make all these linkages that make it very hard to unravel that ball and move forward on nuclear reductions. And then you have two things happen. Both in Russia and the United States, you have presidential elections. And arms control kind of goes on hold during that period from late 2011 to 2012. And a result of that is that instead of Obama-Medvedev, where I think there was something of a chemistry, you have Obama-Putin after the Russian election. And the chemistry there is there, but it's not good chemistry. and there was, on the part of the Obama administration in early 2013, can we reinvigorate arms control? They put forward a new idea on missile defense transparency, but it really got no traction from the Russians. And I think part of the problem here was in Moscow, the context had changed, is that Vladimir Putin, when he came back, when he announced he was going to run, and I think in September of 2011, that really was, I'm going to run, but he was also going to be the president. The election was merely a formality. But Mr. Putin really then began to talk in terms of things like Russian nationalism, Russia is a great power, Russia reasserting its place and voice on the world stage, and a significant bit of anti-Americanism mixed in with that. And it looks like that really is a big part of now how Russia looks at itself in terms of regime legitimacy. So you have domestic politics now driving a more adversarial stance towards the West, and arms control doesn't really fit in well with that. So that becomes a problem. The third phase then comes really after 2014. It follows Russia's illegal seizure of Crimea, the support for armed separatism in eastern Ukraine. And at that point, you really have U.S.-Russia relations crash to the lowest point since the end of the Cold War. Now, the administration here moved to isolate Russia politically, worked with the European Union to apply economic sanctions on Russia, and also generally ratcheted down normal diplomatic business. But it did hold out. There was a carve-out. Exempted was arms control. But there really was no movement, no engagement on that. Also in the summer of 2014, you had the questions arise over the Treaty on Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, when the U.S. government concluded or made public its conclusion that Russia had tested a ground-launched cruise missile to intermediate range in violation of the INF Treaty. The Russians responded with their charges of American violations. So here, arms control now is becoming a problem on the agenda. And again, you hear, I think, more and more Russian complaints about missile defense. So arms control, which at the beginning of the administration was a positive and contributed to a better relationship, by the last couple of years has become a negative. And I think in some ways, just to close up, it seems to me that this is something like both the Clinton and the Bush administration's experience, is at the beginning, arms control, and even though, Steve, as you say, arms control wasn't on the top of the George W. Bush list of things to do, it did do some things in a way that were positive early on in terms of the U.S.-Russia relationship. In the second term, in the Clinton administration, in the Bush administration, and in the Obama administration, arms control issues related to questions like missile defense have become problem issues that have, in fact, contributed to a more difficult relationship.
Thank you both very much. Before I go to questions, I wonder if we could just say, if both of you would like to say a little bit more about what happens if we've now decided that the Russians have violated the INF Treaty and it's sort of dead. What are the implications of that?
I mean, we have pointed a finger at the Russians,
right.
State Department compliance report.
We saw Gorbachev signing this.
We've determined that Russia's testing missiles that are of in excess of INF range, and therefore these tests are illegal. I'm not aware we made a finding that they're actually deploying those kinds of missiles. Although one would suspect if they're testing, they're certainly holding out that option of deploying them. Going back to my time in the Bush administration, I had conversations with Russians where it was very clear they are unhappy with this treaty. And in fairness to the Russians, I mean, they have some legitimate complaints. This is a treaty that forbids missiles of a certain range, but the only countries that are subject to this prohibition are the United States, Russia, and several of the other successor states to the Soviet Union. Iran is not subject to it. North Korea is not subject to it. China is not subject to it. India, Pakistan, not subject. If you're Russia and you're sort of on your periphery are all these countries that are free to deploy these missiles, and some of them are deploying. You start to wonder, how are we supposed to respond? We're forbidden by this treaty that is from a different time with a party that's pretty far away from us. Is this really durable over the long term? I guess relations are getting better with Cuba now, but if Cuba were deploying INF range missiles, how much patience would the United States have with the idea that, we can't reciprocate because we've got this treaty with Russia from 1988? It's been my sense for a long time that at some point the Russians are going to pull out of this just because they're going to say this treaty is an anachronism. And, it seems to me that what we're seeing here is them taking steps in the direction of getting ready to do that. I guess my advice would be, let's not do the Russians a favor of terminating the treaty ourselves if we can avoid it. They just terminated the plutonium disposition agreement. Was it yesterday or this week? They took the hit on that, let them bear the onus for that decision. And likewise on INF, should they proceed to deploy INF range missiles in violation of the treaty, I would hope that they would terminate the treaty in accordance in respect of that decision. If they don't, I guess at that point maybe our hand is forced. But I don't think we should make it easier for the Russians to deploy INF range missiles. In the meantime, I'm all in favor of talking to them to try and persuade them to step back off the ledge. But I do think as long as the rest of the world's free to deploy these kinds of missiles and lots of countries are moving in that direction, it's probably not realistic to expect the Russians to continue to live under the INF treaty over the long term.
I think I'd agree with a lot of Steve's points. Mm-hmm. I do somewhat understand the Russian position where you look at the countries that are developing intermediate range missiles now, they're all much closer to Russia than they are to the United States. Mm-hmm. But having said that, the point I've made to the Russians is, when you look at the panoply of other Russian forces, their strategic forces, their conventional forces, it's not like they really need an intermediate range missile to match what the Chinese have or the Indians have. That would be the first point. That second one, and I agree with Steve here, if the Russians decide they really have a problem, the way to do it is not to cheat on the treaty. It is to exercise the provision which was built into the treaty to withdraw from it. And I think Steve's right is the Russians don't want to do that because they don't want to bear the political responsibility for killing INF. Just a comment on the Obama administration's response. So far, the charge is that Russia has tested but not yet deployed. And I think as long as they haven't deployed, a cautious response makes sense. If they do actually begin to deploy these missiles, it is going to change the game. But one of the reasons why I believe the Obama administration has been relatively cautious, at least on the American side, there's not a specific military requirement at this point in time for building an American intermediate range missile. And if you wanted to build it as a response to the Russian violation, you'd have to put it someplace other than the United States. Having gone through the dual track decision in the early 1980s, when we did deploy Pershing 2 and ground launched cruise missiles, and Bob Einhorn was along with that, as were some others here. It was a pretty painful process. I mean, we ended up doing it, and deploying those missiles in Europe was one of the key reasons why we got the INF Treaty. But I don't know anybody on either side of the Atlantic who would really want to go through that experience again. And so the question is, if we wanted to build an intermediate range missile, where would we put it? I don't think we could put it anywhere that would actually allow it to reach Russia. So our options are somewhat limited in terms of response.
Well, there's also the missile defense response.
Yeah, that's
deploy systems that would shoot down.
Yeah, that's
the range.
Exactly. Now, before we go to questions, I am going to exercise my chairman's right. And I, if you don't mind, call on you, Professor William Hill, as the great expert on the COSAC memorandum, since you've written a book about this. I think this a lot of this is a red herring, but I would like to hear your comments, if you're willing to, about was this a major issue that really scuttled
the U.S. Russian relations? You're going to make me sorry I mentioned the
COSAC. And could you give Professor Hill a... And I have students here from my Russian foreign policy class that I'd normally be teaching at this time. I want them to listen to this, too.
There may be a quiz.
You know, thanks, or maybe I don't know, congratulations or commiseration, but you know, the argument in the book is that the Russians took the... what they took as disrespect and really embarrassing their president...
Could you maybe just explain to people what happened with the COSAC memorandum briefly?
Was a memorandum negotiated by Putin's deputy chief of staff, Dmitry Kozak, at the time sent down to parallel the OSCE negotiations for Transnistrian settlement, that negotiations that I was heading. And I talked with Kozak and couldn't get him to join the efforts. And Kozak claimed that the Moldovans wanted to do it separately. The Moldovan president told me that the Russians wanted to do it separately. The key was probably that the Russians really desired to keep a pretty meaningless troop presence in Transnistria as a political hook, both on Moldova as a whole and on Ukraine, being down in the southwest of Ukraine. But they rushed through the memorandum just ahead of the OSCE presenting an agreed memorandum to the two sides. And the one that they showed to me to get Western approval did not have three key articles in it, which had to do with a long-term Russian troop presence in the country. When the version with the troop presence was leaked to me, I sent it back to a couple of places. The U.S., the time zone meant that the U.S. ambassador had to go in and make the demarche. Solana was able to call himself real time. I think his words to Voronin were, "You can kiss European integration, or you can kiss Moldova's European future goodbye if you sign this." Voronin agonized the night before Putin was to come to the country and sign the memorandum, and called him about 4 or 5 in the morning. The press, Russian press, was already on the plane. Putin was preparing to fly down. And this happened 2 days after Shevardnadze was carried out of the Georgian parliament on live TV. And there were Moldovan citizens protesting with nooses in trees outside the presidential building in Chisinau. In any case, the Russians took it very seriously. The point of the book is that the Russians take the near abroad much more seriously than we do. Think, you know, missiles in Cuba or Russians in Cuba. You remember the Cuban Brigade in 78, 79 when that broke. I think that had been there for... Anyway, the fallout, it was about that time, and whether it was Georgia, whether it was Moldova, whether it was all of them together, it was a clear turning point in what had been, in my perception, on the ground out there from my own foxhole, of a Russia that we were able to cooperate with on some at some point or on some things, and a Russia that was more suspicious and less willing to let Westerners of various sorts in. The attitude, whether this is accurate or not, but certainly a week later, Igor Ivanov screamed at us from across the table at the Maastricht meeting, stating, "When you intervened in the Balkans, we didn't like it, but we didn't stop it. And we then get an agreement and a settlement in our area, and you wreck it." And things went downhill from that time. But, you know, as you've pointed out, they go up and they go down again. They go up again, they go down again. But they remember it far more than we do, because it is really in their backyard. The position of Kozak at the time was equivalent to Steve Hadley. And so you can imagine what would have happened had there been an appropriate mirror image. In any case, it's part of an area that's sensitive to them, remains sensitive, as you and others have noted, and one that we sometimes don't appreciate the importance that they attach to these countries. And we saw that again in Ukraine in 2013, 2014.
Thank you very much. Could I have a footnote?
I was actually the Deputy Assistant Secretary who signed out the instruction to the American Ambassador in Moldova responding to the Kozak Memorandum. The way the President Voronin came to us was, he told our ambassador, I have this memorandum, the Kozak Memorandum. I propose to sign it. I would like an American endorsement. And I think in parallel, he was asking the Europeans to do the same thing. We took a look at the memorandum, and our conclusion was it's unworkable, because it basically gave Transnistria, the breakaway piece of Moldova, the ability to veto foreign policy, security policy. Had Moldova said, we want to draw closer to the European Union, Transnistria could veto it. So we went back to Voronin. We said, look, it's not our place to tell you not to sign this. You know, you can sign this, but we're not going to endorse it. And the sense of the embassy was, Voronin wanted to be able to go to his population because he thought there would be domestic pushback and say, the Americans and the Europeans are making me do this. So it's, you know.
First version is the one you looked at and came back, and we told him, the OSCE did the same thing, told him that we couldn't support it, but we felt if he was going to sign it, we couldn't steer him off because you had not yet seen the portion or the articles with the troop presence. And there was a two-part thing. He definitely wanted Western, both U.S., OSCE, and EU approval of doing it. He had told the Russians this, allegedly, he told me later, that the Russians told him that the OSCE had approved, which was not the case. But it's clouded in stories of each participant who claims that they did it one way or another. The point is, at the end of the day, with Putin sitting in Moscow, Kozak at the airport really angry, and Voronin wondering what he had done, you had resentments on all sides of something that had been that close to settling one of the things and had failed spectacularly. Sort of like other things that are being talked about. Yeah.
All right. Well, here we have the dueling narratives problem vividly explained. All right. We do have time for questions on arms control, on other aspects of U.S.-Russian relations, responding to what you've heard. So, all right, we'll start off with you. And if you could, you will identify yourself.
Hello, my name is Jeff Hahn. I'm a master's student at American University. I wanted to, in the last panel, they discussed the Reykjavik summit in great detail, which was very fascinating. And I was wondering about the legacy, specifically of Gorbachev and his warm relations with the United States and the impact that has on Putin and any future Russian leader, because Gorbachev is so widely despised in Russia today. And I believe any future Russian leader would fear looking weak, especially on the subject of arms control. Do you feel that this negatively impacts future negotiations?
It's a good question. Who would like to take that up?
I don't have any great insights into the sort of the Russian psyche on that issue. But, I do think we need to understand, Russia's going to do what's, it's a great nation, okay? Russia's going to do what's in its national interest. And, conventional wisdom is that, countries that feel weak on conventional terms, in terms of their conventional forces, often fall back to nuclear weapons as the safeguard for their security. That was what we did during the Cold War when we felt that we were inferior conventionally in Europe to what the Warsaw Pact was able to deploy. Today, clearly, the roles are reversed. I mean, the Russians think they've lost most of their allies. They feel weak relative to NATO, and I hope this doesn't come as a shock to anybody. But like Obama's agenda of we're going to abolish nuclear weapons from the face of the earth, that's a nice aspiration, But I think you will find zero support in you know, high levels of the Russian government for moving in that direction. And if that's our objective, to negotiate the abolition of nuclear weapons, like apparently was on offer in Reykjavik, I don't think we're going to find takers in Russia. Now, is that because of the Gorbachev legacy? No, I don't think so. I think it's a hard-headed calculation by the Russian leadership of where their national interest lies in the current global security environment. And maybe I'll just go further. I think Obama, a big part of Obama's problem in negotiating with Russia is he has set this grandiose objective, and it's his objective. It's not Putin hasn't embraced this as his objective, but Obama's success is sort of being measured with reference to how much success he achieves in realizing this objective. To make progress, he needs to sign agreements with Russia. If you're the Russians, that's a source of leverage, right? I mean, Obama wants something, you're not really enthusiastic. It's sort of the flip side of what we faced during the Bush administration. They were the enthusiastic ones for agreements, we weren't, and so we got to impose our terms. Today, what Obama faces is he's the one who has this political need to sign new arms control agreements with Russia, and the Russians don't really have that need. I think they're basically satisfied with the current arms control regime. I mean, it's, New START will expire, and we can deal with that later. I don't think the Russians want a nuclear arms race, but they don't need nuclear reductions. They to make Obama happy, they'd probably be prepared to agree to some for a price, but it would be a price that we would pay, not a price that they would pay. And that's Obama's frustration, of course, that the Russians are trying to make him pay a price. I think he might have actually more success if he hadn't set this grandiose objective and hitched his own political fortunes to a success in trying to achieve it.
I think the Reykjavik legacy was actually much more in the short term, whereas despite the initial sense that the summit had failed, within just a little bit over a year, you had the INF Treaty for the first time banning an entire class of nuclear weapons. A couple years later, you had the START 1 Treaty, so pretty significant achievements. As I make the point, as I think Ken Edelman said, it did make thinking about going to zero respectable. I personally think I support the idea of a world without nuclear weapons. I think it makes sense as a U.S. policy goal, though I don't know how we can get there. But that's based on two reasons. One is I worry that nuclear deterrence, while it succeeded during the Cold War, a couple times came very close to breaking down. And the result of a breakdown would have been 400 million dead. So the question is, do you want to live with that risk? I think actually if you could have a verifiable non-nuclear world, for the United States, given geography, given alliance structures, given American conventional power, the risks in that kind of world are less than a nuclear world. I think Mr. Putin, though, doesn't buy into that at all. He looks at his situation and says, wait, I am the leader of a declining power with a stagnant economy. I have 1.5 billion Chinese next door. Nuclear weapons are about the only way I secure my security. And that's going to be, I think, why getting to or even moving in the direction significantly of a nuclear weapon is going to be difficult, because the Russian perception from their security is just very, very different from the way we would look at it.
Okay. Yes.
Hi, I'm Kate Boffman. I'm a master's student up at Georgetown University in Dr. Sen's class. I got the impression from your particular comments about the INF Treaty and the possibility that Russia may, in one way or another, find itself outside of that treaty or, not necessarily back out because of the political consequences, but break it. And I was wondering, it seems to me like then it does have, Russia does in this case, have an interest in maybe an update of the treaty as opposed to backing out of it, an update to include the circumstances of today's world and the presence of nuclear weapons and other actors that are not included in the treaty. And it seems like on this particular issue, they may have more interest than some of the other areas. And I was wondering if there's any possibility that could come about.
Well, in terms of, you know, modifying the INF treaty, the one idea you'll often hear suggested is instead of getting rid of the INF treaty, why don't we globalize it? So in other words, address Russia's concern by expanding the group of subject the group of countries that are subject to its restrictions. In principle, that sounds like a great idea. But I think you need to talk to the Chinese, the Indians, the North Koreans. How many of them are actually interested in doing that? I think opponents of that idea argue that proposals to globalize, proposals to mount an effort to globalize the INF Treaty will probably translate in practice to the abolition of the INF Treaty because the effort will be mounted, it will fail, and then those who tried to globalize it will have a good excuse for explaining why they've decided. Since the rest of the world has expressed no interest in this treaty, why should we keep it? That would be a conclusion one could draw if efforts to globalize the INF Treaty collapsed. Short of globalizing it, I'm not sure how you adjust it to. Maybe you could try and come up with in certain areas Russia could have INF range missiles, but not in the European theater. That idea, I'm sure, was discussed at the time the treaty was originally negotiated, but, missiles of that size are mobile, so, if Russia has them in one theater, they can move them to another in a crisis. So I'm not sure that would be a modification we would be very comfortable with.
Yeah, I think in the second Bush term, I think in either 2007 or 2008, the Russians made a proposal at the UN, which the U.S. government supported, to globalize the INF treaty. There were no takers. So it hasn't been pushed really since then.
Okay. Yes, over there. Lady in red.
Christina McAllister. I've supported U.S. nonproliferation programs for about 10 years. I was just curious, with the elections coming up here and recent Duma elections in Russia, what nonproliferation arms control goals would you recommend for the next administration?
Good question.
I guess you've had enough panels about the Iran nuclear agreement, so maybe I shouldn't take us there.
You can take us wherever you want.
With Russia, I'm not optimistic that great progress is in prospect. I honestly think the United States looks kind of ridiculous coming in asking for deeper reductions in nuclear weapons when Russia's sort of on the march in places like Ukraine. Russians must look at us like we're from another planet and we don't quite get what's going on. So I'd set aside Russia for the most part. The big problems on the horizon are Iran and North Korea. I think, especially if it's a Hillary Clinton administration, I think there may be consideration given to some sort of new diplomatic initiative to try and replicate the perceived success achieved with Iran on the Korean Peninsula. Personally, I'm skeptical that. Any negotiation with North Korea basically involves the bribes that we will give them to stop doing bad things, and I think the history of the last 25 years demonstrates that the North Koreans are very happy to accept bribes. They're not actually happy to deliver on their part of the bargain, so I don't know why expect a different outcome. The Clinton administration tried that. The Bush administration tried it. To its credit, the Obama administration hasn't tried it. I think they recognize that. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Fool me a third time, what you say about that. But that's basically where we are if we start trying to bribe the North Koreans again to give up their nuclear weapons program. Iran, there are lots of people celebrating how we solved that problem. I personally think we put it on hold for 10 years, and it'll be back in a much more virulent form, with us having signed off on a much more robust nuclear weapons infrastructure, if that's what they want to have, and have basically no ability to restrain them should they wish to break out in 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, I think the next administration, in terms of arms control, non-proliferation, the urgent issue is going to be North Korea. Thus far, Russia's really kind of a bit player in that. I mean, it's not that they have huge influence with the North Koreans, so I'm not sure that figures in a big way on the U.S.-Russia agenda. You know, if you got back to some kind of a dialogue between the United States and Russia on arms control, you know, if you wanted to move forward, you'd have to reconcile, I think, what are two very different approaches, which is what has been, at least in the last 8 years, an American desire to move to further reductions but also bring in non-strategic nuclear weapons, and the Russian desire to focus on issues like missile defense, advanced conventional strike, third country systems. Now, there may be ways to bridge those differences, but it would take quite a bit of work.
Yep.
Marwa Mazia, the University of Washington. I was fascinated by the way you talked about how negotiation and enthusiasm and that element affects negotiations. I would like you to reflect a little bit more on the moment of unilateralism at this period of time. And unilaterally, the United States decides one thing, and the way you're narrating it, that the Russians would come and say, let's put it in a treaty, please, treat us as equal almost. And then how you narrated that somehow there is a change in the context in Moscow, the national context in Moscow, and that there is more aggression moving forward. So if you can piece these two episodes together, do you see that moment is actually a reflection or a response to a moment of more strengths on the United States' part, affording unilateralism, and now this is the time to pay the price you were talking about, but kind of a justified or rational price.
Do you want to start?
I think if you look at how Putin looks at the United States, there's pieces. Part of what is driving him is domestic politics. It goes back to 2000 to 2008. Putin was good on economics because the price of oil went up and the economy grew and living standards rose. And that was sort of, you know, this is what regime legitimacy is about. When he came back to the presidency in 2012, the economic situation was much more complex. And that's when you see, I think, this appeal now to Russian nationalism, restoration of Russian great power. And that's been a big part of it. But I think another part of it goes back, and this goes back to both the Bush administration and also the Clinton administration, is Putin has this huge chip on his shoulder, this sense of grievance that the United States at the West mistreated Russia. And he cites NATO enlargement. You know, in his version of NATO enlargement is NATO enlargement was organized by the United States, Britain, and Germany to contain Russia, to bring military force up to Russia's borders. I think it was very different. It was designed to respond to appeals by Central European countries who basically said, we want to be full members of Europe. Likewise, if you look at the way he talks about the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, the Rose Revolution in Georgia, the Maidan Revolution, these aren't manifestations of populations that say, wait, our election was stolen, or we're unhappy with bad governance. Again, in the way Putin describes it, these are Western plots, usually American plots, again, designed to promote regime change, and the ultimate target is regime change in Moscow. And he talks about it so much that in some sense, I think he actually believes it. Now, I think the reality is very different, but from his perspective, he has this sense of grievance. He has this sense that he's defending against an encroaching West, and that may explain things why he's less interested in arms control, why he worries more about missile defense, because he has this perception that I personally think is wrong, but perception, you know, can be a reality.
Well, you use the term unilateralism, and since I served in the Bush administration, when that term is thrown out in connection with the Bush administration, it's usually a criticism. But you know, the unilateralism that's criticized was not ever the decision unilaterally to reduce nuclear weapons. I mean, there were other unilateral decisions, perhaps, that were criticized.
Did you use the term?
It was a unilateral. I mean, it was not a negotiated nuclear reduction. It was a unilateral U.S. decision about reductions that we decided to make, and you know, we invited. I mean, there was precedent for that. George H.W. Bush for the non-strategic nuclear weapons announced unilateral U.S. reductions that were then reciprocated by President Yeltsin. And I think that was basically the Bush vision, George W. Bush vision, or the hope, was that in announcing nuclear reductions on our side, strategic nuclear reductions, that the Russians would match them unilaterally, so, as had happened with the non-strategic nuclear weapons. But in the end, the Russians wanted a treaty, and I don't, you know, I think they were probably, in fact, I'm sure they were frustrated, because they like using the treaty negotiating process to try and leverage the U.S. on other issues like missile defense and conventional strategic weapons, and they have a whole list of things that they want to, you know, try and slowly advance their interests by taking arms control negotiations hostage. I mean, that was the history of the, you know, the New START negotiation took much longer than it really should have, and that was because the Russians kept trying to link it to other issues to see whether in Obama's enthusiasm to get this treaty, he'd be prepared to make concessions on things that previously the U.S. hadn't been willing to talk about.
Richard Pearl, I'm going to give him the microphone over there. It's coming this way. No, there's the mic.
Thank you. Can I encourage the panel to comment on the proposition that the intellectual architecture of arms control as we knew it during the Cold War is in fact an anachronism today? And arms control as we have understood it in the past is not very important, not very relevant, and no matter whether we attempt agreements or choose not to attempt agreements, it isn't going to make much difference.
I think we'll start with Steve Pfeiffer first.
you're giving the supporting argument.
I think that's largely true, actually. I mean, you know, the history of arms control was we were in a nuclear arms race, and that was the Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon administrations, and the first goal of arms control was to stop the arms race. And then under Reagan, it moved to trying to roll back weapons levels. But, you know, I think the world, we do face a different security environment today. And, I mean, there's no nuclear arms race that's prospect. I mean, no country is going to, you know, spend billions of dollars, maybe more than billions of dollars, to try and gain nuclear advantage in the current environment. I think in a lot of ways, arms control can be actually an obstacle to improved relations, because you set up these processes and especially the way, like, I have some sympathy for the Russians. Okay, they are playing a weak hand. Okay, I mean that's what we're facing. They're playing a weak hand, and they are. What do you do when you have a weak hand? Well, you better play it pretty well because you don't have much margin for error. So they use these processes to try and gain advantage, to create linkages, to achieve concessions in other unrelated areas. And, I do think it often ends up bollocksing up the relationship. And, I think sometimes we're much better off, as we were during the Bush administration, saying, essentially, we're indifferent to this, you know, negotiations, arms control agreements. You know, we'll do one with you if it makes you feel better, but we're not gonna spend 6 years in Geneva hammering one out and letting you, you know, throw all these other issues on the agenda that we don't want to talk about in Geneva. You know, take it or leave it. You know, here's what we're prepared to agree to. And I think Obama's problem is that, you know, he's got this agenda of abolishing nuclear weapons, so he needs agreements to make progress toward his objective. And that, like I said earlier, that invites the Russians to try and make him pay a price for doing that. I mean, that's what they need to do with the weak hand of cards that they have to play.
Case for arms control.
Well, I think that there still is value in using arms control as a tool to reduce the number of nuclear weapons that could strike the United States. You've got to be smart about how you do the negotiations, but I think bringing the numbers down does make sense. Also, arms control agreements often produce a lot of transparency. I think the Joint Chiefs, their support for New START was based on the idea that you get notifications, you get inspections, you get data exchanges, so you know a lot more about Russian nuclear forces than you would know just using your own unilateral means. So I think there still is a place for it. And I guess on the unilateral side, Steve, I know the Bush administration did make that, yes, we're going to go down to 2,200 nuclear weapons, and we're fine, you do what you want. It would have been interesting to see the reaction had the Russians come back and said, fine, we're going to stay at START 1, we're going to stay at 6,000 weapons. So I do think that there is a continued place for arms control in terms of containing a competition that I think is potentially dangerous. I mean, the risk is small in a breakdown, but if you do have a breakdown in nuclear deterrence, the results are catastrophic. And I do agree with the Obama administration's conclusion in its nuclear posture view that to the extent that we can decrease the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. policy and shift it more to conventional weapons, areas where I think there actually are significant U.S. advantages, that's in our interest.
Yes. Give the microphone over there.
My name is Natalia Ortolan. I'm an undergraduate student at Georgetown in Dr. Stent's class. So from this panel, I get the sense that a great difficulty facing future arms control agreements is the fact that Russia perceives threats from its nuclear neighbors, which is not a reality that the U.S. has. So obviously you want to avoid making concessions from the U.S. perspective. So how would one approach future negotiations to ease Russia into the idea that making and reducing these arms numbers is important, but from their perspective that they don't want to do this?
I said earlier, you know, Russia's a great power with lots of intelligent people in leadership positions. I mean, they are perfectly, in fact, nothing makes the Russians angrier than to be lectured by an American about what's in their interest. they really get mad when they're lectured by Americans about what's in Russia's national interest. And so, I mean, the idea that we're going to educate them about, you know, how to better deal with the Chinese nuclear threat that they perceive, or, you know, how to deal with Iran, I mean, you know, we need to be really careful and we need to be realistic about what can be achieved in those areas. I mean, progress will be possible on arms control when Russia concludes that it's in Russia's interest to do an arms control agreement. And I think right now they're basically happy. You know, Steve was talking about the transparency, the verification aspects of arms control. I do think that's important to the U.S. It's also important, frankly, it's more important to the Russians, because we have much better satellite surveillance capabilities. We have a much clearer idea what's going on the ground in Russia than they do in the United States. And so the transparency under these arms control agreements it's important to both sides, but I would argue even more important to Russia than the United States. And that's why it's astonishing, actually, when you look back at the negotiation of the New START treaty, that what the Russians kept trying to do was pare back the verification, because, you know, they were, it was a way of sticking it to the Obama administration, and they were trying to take away things that they thought were, you know, more useful to the U.S. than to them. I think it's a tribute to the way the U.S. sort of backed into that negotiation, and President Obama needed that deal more than they did politically, so they were able to try and bring in all these other issues and also pare back the verification. But at the end of the day, it's in their interest to have verification. I think if we approach negotiations with them in a less enthusiastic, you know, less breathless manner, we'll actually get a better result.
I guess I'd go back. Under the New START treaty, Russia is going to have 1,500 deployed strategic nuclear warheads. And the Federation of American Scientists estimate is that Russia has a total arsenal now of somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 total nuclear weapons. You know, I think that number allows them to feel pretty comfortable against, you know, North Korea or India or Pakistan or Saudi Arabia or Iran, countries that have intermediate range missiles. They don't need to sort of insist that there be some involvement by these other countries. Now, there is a question. I mean, the Russians have now said there has to be some kind of a multilateral aspect to the next negotiation. What the Russians haven't said is how they would envisage a multilateral negotiation going. And they haven't said that because when you try to think it through, it's very, very difficult to come up with a negotiation that doesn't either ask that the United States and Russia come down to the levels of Britain, France, and China, or ask that those latter three countries accept unequal limitations, which they're unlikely to do in a legally binding treaty. So maybe you could begin to get to a notion where if the United States and Russia were to do another agreement going beyond New START, maybe you could ask Britain, France, and China to make a unilateral commitment that they won't increase as long as the United States and Russia are coming down. But you're not going to be able to get much in terms of third countries when there's this huge gap with the United States and Russia, each at maybe 4,500 nuclear weapons, and nobody else above 300.
Jill Doherty, you get the next question.
Hi, Jill Doherty. I'm with the a fellow with the Woodrow Wilson Center and also a former student of Angela Stent. And I just had a question on the, not necessarily on arms control, but on the modernization of nuclear weapons. You know, we have President Obama who talks about reducing the numbers, and yet we're looking at this proposed $1 trillion, I believe, that could be spent over a number of years on modernizing the United States' nuclear weapons, potential for a nuclear-armed cruise missile, et cetera. Could you bring us to the Russian perspective on this? I know they've been doing some modernization of their own, but what is their $1 trillion plan? Are they going to match this? What's their view?
Well, the Russians announced a $700 billion plan to modernize all of their military forces. And what they've talked about specifically on the strategic side is in over a 10-year period, and we're now about halfway through it, I think it was building 400 intercontinental ballistic missiles and submarine-launched ballistic missiles. And if you look at the force that it looks like Russia wants to have within the limits of the New START treaty, that looks like about the right number. Part of what the Russians are doing, like what we'll be doing in the 2020s, is they're building new missiles to replace old stuff. And there's a lot of, I think, missiles in the Russian inventory now that had they had the money back in the 1990s or the early 2000s, they would have replaced 10 years ago. So a lot of it is just replacing old stuff, and it looks like they are now sizing a force within the level of the New START agreement. There'll be a similar process on the U.S. side. I think, you know, one of the things, modernization is always hard to talk about sometimes because we're never in sync. So the Russians are doing a lot now. They're building new submarines, new submarine-launched ballistic missiles, new intercontinental ballistic missiles. 10 years from now, they're going to be done. We're going to be building new intercontinental ballistic missiles, new submarines, and you know, a new bomber. A lot of it, again, I think, is replacing old stuff, and is necessary. I do, though, when I look at the U.S. Strategic Modernization Program, I would question certain aspects of it. And what does worry me is when you have the Pentagon saying, here's our plan, and by the way, nobody in the Pentagon has the faintest idea how we're going to afford to build this. You know, we're kind of leaving a time bomb for whoever has to manage that problem 10 years down the road. And maybe we ought to think a little bit more in a long-term sense about, you know, are there ways that you could design a modernization program? And I think we should continue to maintain a triad. I would adjust some of the numbers. I do question the need for a new long-range cruise missile when you're going to spend $80 billion to build a new bomber that supposedly has stealth and advanced electronic warfare capabilities. But, you know, we're going to have to come to grips with this, and I think that the next administration is going to have to deal with those questions. Otherwise, it's going to find itself in a position around 2025 where it's talking about, do we build new intercontinental ballistic missiles, or do we buy F-35 aircraft, or do we buy frigates? And I don't think the Pentagon has come to grips with that, and the next 10 years we're going to have to do that.
Yeah, I'd simply say, you know, if you're with President Obama and you think, you know, we're on the cusp of the abolition of nuclear weapons, you know, hopefully during his lifetime, that was the yardstick he put out, then, yeah, I mean, these investments make no sense. You know, why spend all this money to produce weapons that will then dismantle? But if you don't actually think that that goal is likely to be realized, and that's sort of the category I'm in, then, of course, you have to spend the money because we're going to be in this business for a long time to come. And, you know, weapon systems, that, you know, B-52s built in the 1950s, you know, they're not going to last forever, and they need to be replaced, and replacement's going to cost money. And I do get exasperated at this trillion-dollar figure. That's the 30-year cost estimate. You know, I don't know what the 30-year cost estimate was for Obamacare, but you know what? We never heard it during the debate because, at least from the proponents of Obamacare, because it would have been such an enormous number, it would have scared people off. And, you know, when you start quoting 30-year numbers, it's with the intention of scaring people off. I mean, the right number to look at is the annual cost. You know, you don't look at how much you're going to pay over the lifetime of the mortgage. If you've ever done that, you would never sign a mortgage. So what is the annual cost of making these investments, and how does that compare to the sums we've spent in the past on the nuclear enterprise? And the reality is, it's a lot less money than we spent during the Cold War on nuclear weapons, and we somehow got through the, you know, we managed to fund national defense throughout the Cold War. So I mean, the numbers are not quite as daunting as the critics would have us believe.
So we've been agreeing too much. So let me push back on 2 points here, just to end up. I disagree. I mean, I think President Obama in Prague put out this notion of a world without nuclear weapons, but I disagree. I don't think it really has been operationalized. I mean, if you look at the strategic modernization program that the Obama administration approved, I mean, they're talking about 12 ballistic missile submarines, they're talking about 640 intercontinental ballistic missiles, a new cruise missile, a new bomber. I mean, they're basically, he's going along with everything that the Pentagon would have wanted. So I'm not sure I see in that program, and I don't think I see in the absence of some unilateral things that the Obama administration could have done in the last 4 or 5 years, that he's wildly pushing towards that vision. And I said, I agree with the vision. I'm not sure we can get there, probably not. But I think he did put down qualifiers in Prague when he said, as long as there are nuclear weapons here, we have to have a reliable deterrent. The other point I guess I would push back is on the cost question. And I think, once you talk about 30-year numbers, that's difficult. But if you look at the current budget environment, and if you look at projections for the growth in Social Security, Medicare, interest rates, I really think it would be unwise for the Pentagon to make an assumption that 10 years from now, a pot of money is going to appear that's suddenly going to allow them to avoid hard choices between building intercontinental ballistic missiles and F-35s and things like that. And if we think like that, my guess is what we're going to do is we're going to start spending a lot of money on programs and then curtail those programs after we've done the development, after we bought the first 20 units that are this cost, but before we can get down to where the cost